Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the March 15th, Ides of March, meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. A couple of preliminaries. Remember that there are emergency exits to my right in the back of the room and to my left in the front of the room. If there should be a fire, please don't use the elevator. I wonder if you'd stand with me and pledge allegiance to the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I'd like to roll call the members, please.
Mr. John?
Present.
Ms. Kellis?
Present.
Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Mr. Klein?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
Here.
Mr. Morey?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chalk?
I am here.
Mr. Dennis?
I'm present.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
14 members present.
We have a full complement and we have quorum. Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
I'm pleased to have a proclamation this evening, and I wondered if we might ask our county clerk, Maureen Reynolds, to come up to the podium. I'm going to read the proclamation. It reads, whereas through our membership with the New York State Association of Counties and the New York State Association of County Clerks, New York counties have come together to collectively support Organ Donation Month. And whereas currently nearly 124,000 men, women, and children are awaiting organ transplants in the United States, and whereas organ, tissue, marrow, and blood donation are life-giving acts recognized worldwide as expressions of compassion to those in need, and whereas a single individual's donation of the heart, lungs, liver, kidneys, pancreas, and small intestine can save up to 8 lives, donation of tissue can save and heal the lives of up to 50 others, and a single blood donation can help 3 people in need. And whereas New York State, there are approximately 10,000 people waiting for an organ transplant, which represents the third highest need in the nation, and there's an estimated 500 New Yorkers who die every year while waiting for an organ transplant. And whereas the Tompkins County Clerk's Office and the Department of Motor Vehicles have partnered to promote the month of April as Organ Donation Month and will participate in many activities throughout the month in order to increase the number of organ and tissue donors and to promote awareness in Tompkins County. Now, therefore, I, Michael Lane, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim the month of April 2016 as Organ Donation Month. And in doing so, all residents of Tompkins County are encouraged to enroll as an organ and tissue donor at our local DMV office. I want to present this to Maureen.
Sir, I'd like to tell you that Tompkins County, we have the highest rate of organ donation in the state at almost 45%. But my DMV staff are really excited. We're going to have some contests on, you know, T-shirts and who can get the most organ donors. I get to go to lunch with me each week. So we're really proud. We're trying to make it a lot higher. So thank you.
Thank you, Maureen. Our county clerk's office does a great job for us. And so does DMV. We do need an executive session tonight after the meeting to discuss litigation issues. I'm going to reorder a little bit tonight. I want to, we have some folks from out of area that are here to make a brief presentation to us. So I'm going to turn to Martha Robertson. Martha, would you please introduce your guest tonight, and then would you please move to your resolution D?
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Mike. Our guest is Omai Elphick from Gravity Renewables. He's based in Saratoga Springs, but the company's based in Colorado, and we're very excited to have a project that that Jonathan Wood in particular has been working on a long time with Gravity Renewables. So the resolution is in your folder. There's a revised version.
I said it should be Resolution F. I said the wrong number.
Right. Thanks, Mike. Slight revision from your original packet. Authorizing a hydroelectric utility remote net metering agreement with Gravity Renewables Incorporated. I so move.
Is there a second? Seconded by Carol Chalk.
And we have a...
Go ahead.
Do you want to bring this...
You want the screens
do the
down?
PowerPoint, right?
Let's suspend long enough to put the screens down, please. Martha, do you want to speak briefly to the resolution while that's happening?
Sure. Yeah, this is the... Something that was made possible by an agreement with Mega 2 years ago, 3 years ago, to encourage development of small hydroelectric plants. And as people know, New York State has a history, a legacy of hydro power, and Gravity Renewables has been very creative in finding the right kind of facilities that are ripe for... Can y'all hear me? Okay. Gravity Renewables has been very creative in finding the right kind of facilities that are ripe for rejuvenation, for retrofitting with modern controls, and to make use of the resource, the completely renewable and very reliable resource we have of water power in this country, in this state. And everybody's got a packet of materials here. Omai came to the planning committee meeting on Friday and spent more than an hour and a half answering lots and lots of questions. So I'm sure he'll answer whatever questions we have. But I just want to point out.
Martha, I'm not sure we all have that at this
doesn't
point.
Doesn't everybody have a packet like this? Do you have one, Mike?
I don't happen to have one, but that's all right. If everybody else has it, that's fine. Thank you.
So in your packet is the cover is an article from Power Magazine. No, not about politics, but about energy. And it highlights, there's an article from March 28, 1916, almost exactly 100 years ago, sort of celebrating the start of this plan. And you can see, that's the same picture there that was in the paper 100 years ago. And we are, if we approve this, we are going to set ourselves on the path of kind of, this is as good adaptive reuse as I can imagine, and something that really is quintessential recycling. So I'm excited about this project. I'm really grateful to Jonathan for working through it with the firm. And I just hope everybody is ready to say yes to it. I think it's going to provide about two-thirds of Tompkins County's electricity needs, which is really wonderful. So with that, Omai, please go ahead and take us through the presentation. And then I'm sure we'll have any other questions. We'll have time afterwards. So thanks. Thanks, Mike, for moving this up.
Okay. Thank you very much. So I've been asked to go through this presentation and then take your questions at the end. But if there's anything glaring, please feel free to interject. Martha talked about the history here. We're going to review both the history of the actual site but also of the project and give you a high-level summary of the mechanics. And obviously, this is a great story that we're on the cusp of really celebrating and propelling this project into its next 100 years of operation is really a remarkable story. The photo that you see here is a photo taken just after the original commissioning in 1915, and I'll show you some more recent photos in a moment. So as you know and as outlined in the packet, this project was originally is sponsored by a partnership between Tompkins County and the Municipal Electric and Gas Alliance. It was procured through a competitive bid process in late 2013. The award was for providing remotely net metered hydro projects was made to Gravity Renewables, our company, in early 2014, and in like your competitive supply electricity, this project benefits from the collective purchasing power and organization that MEGA has been offering its members since the mid-90s. All the documents that are part of this arrangement and agreements were part of that original bid and solicitation and have, you know, been previewed and negotiated as part of that. And Jonathan Wood has been obviously a central part in that. So said another way, MEGA offers both the competitive procurement but also the document control and review that you've enjoyed for so many years. MEGA's goal in all of this is to provide price stability among other things to its members, and we'll talk about how this project does that. Tompkins County, the goal set forth to us as we started to look at an appropriate matching project was to reduce the county's environmental impacts through involvement in a renewable energy project, in addition, of course, to stabilizing its energy costs. There's a significant amount of information in your packet about Gravity Renewables, but briefly, we are an investor, owner, and operator of small hydro facilities. We have a portfolio that's approaching 30 megawatts scattered across the United States with a concentration in the Northeast. We are privately funded, and as I'll outline later in the presentation, this project that we're discussing with you is being privately funded and not relying on any federal or state subsidies, grants, or tax credits. And these are just some of the projects that we've publicly announced. St. Lawrence County, one of your peer counties, is doing a project with us in the North Country. St. Lawrence University, Skidmore College, Vassar, and others outside of New York. So the basic mechanism here that's relatively new, so we're talking about a proven technology that's obviously been around for over a century, but the mechanism that allows us to generate electricity about 45 minutes north of here and convey it to the county is a mechanism called remote net metering. And in its most simplest form, and I say that tongue-in-cheek because the tariff that describes it is anything but simple, but the concept is, in fact, very simple. The county here is paying Gravity Renewables, will be paying Gravity Renewables a fee to operate that is based on a per kilowatt hour basis. So every kilowatt hour that we generate will provide an invoice to you, and you'll pay us to operate. In return, what you receive is a credit on your electric bill, which is forecasted to be more valuable than the amount that you're paying us. And what's remarkable about this is that years ago, well, I say years ago, originally to transmit electricity from point A to point B, you have to run a wire, and wires are expensive. This is virtual, and this transmission takes place essentially in the accounting department at NYSEG. At significantly less cost than running wires. And so that is remote net metering, and that's the mechanism that all of the solar projects that you've seen in the news and all of the hydro projects that we're working on, this is the mechanism that is allowing us to transmit the electricity. It's important to note that this mechanism, and particularly the crediting of dollars to your electric account, that was seen by the Public Service Commission last year as providing too much sort of an unintended economic upside to the customer, you, the county. And so they changed the rules. And through significant lobbying on behalf of the county and MEGA and other organizations, certain types of projects and entities were grandfathered. So we just want to point out here that Tompkins County is grandfathered to, in part because it started its project in good faith before the June 2015 deadline. One of the other deadlines that's worth noting is that, you know, projects that are grandfathered need to be completed before the end of 2017, something that we're, you know, that is well within the timeline that we've budgeted for doing this project. So, small hydro in New York. There's a much longer, interesting history about small hydro in New York. New York, of course, its settlement patterns, its economy, its basic economic foundation is very much shaped by the waterways for transportation and for generating electricity. And so part of that legacy represented in this map are all these dots are all of the hydro facilities that are eligible for the MEGA, for the program that MEGA sponsored. And so our task here is to find a site that matches the MEGA members' load, the county's electric consumption load, but is also located close enough so that it satisfies the requirements of the law. And so here's the filtering that we went through. There are about 75 eligible remote net metering sites in upstate New York. Tompkins County consumes about 6 million kilowatt hours a year. It's located in load zone C, which is the central load zone. It's also located in NYSEG territory. To satisfy the requirements of the law, the hydro facility also needs to be located in load zone C and the NYSEG territory. And so of those 75 eligible plants, it turns out that there is exactly one plant that meets those needs. There are, in fact, three other plants that might have met your needs, except that two of them are owned by the city of Auburn, and they like them, so they're keeping them. And the other one is owned by Cornell University, and that's the one that's that you see, the blue dot that you see in the Ithaca area. So that was an easy analysis. So this project we went through the procurement process. In April 2014, we signed a non-binding letter of intent with the county, contingent on Gravity's ability to get permission to transfer the federal license from the current owner to Gravity, in addition to a number of other authorizations. And, of course, Gravity's ability to successfully purchase the plant. And so in late 2015 and early 2016, we reached those milestones. And so that brings us here today, which is presenting to you and authorizing the county administrator to move forward in the next steps of the project, including the execution of an operating agreement, as well as the submittal of the interconnection agreement to NYSEG, which will authorize the connection, that virtual connection between the plant and the county, so the county can receive the benefit of the generation. So I'd like now to switch gears and talk specifically about this plant and some of its rich history. So this map This map here is a watershed map, but you'll recognize Rochester up here, Lake Ontario, and, of course, Ithaca and the lakes that you travel around regularly. So the plant called Waterloo is
located... 6 inches away works best.
Six. Is that good there?
Yep.
Okay. So Seneca Lake flows into Seneca River. The very first obstacle Seneca River encounters is Waterloo, and there is also a New York Canal Authority lock there, and the water continues down there through Seneca Falls, and then ultimately through the facilities in Auburn until it. Makes its way on towards Lake Ontario. So the plant itself, as Martha mentioned earlier, built just about a little over 100 years ago by Empire Gas and Electric in order to power the towns and the communities between Geneva and Auburn. Obviously, back then, residential customers didn't have electric service as broadly as we do today. And these plants were, this plant was built in conjunction with four steam-powered plants to power the local grid, primarily to provide electricity for industrial customers such as International Harvester and other mills in the area. What's remarkable about this article in the Power Journal is that at the time they were touting this as being innovative, latest, robust technology for the time, designed to stand the test of time. And I'm not sure we'll know whether they planned it to last 100 years, but it has in pretty good fashion. And with a commitment from Tompkins County to purchase the generation over the next 20 years, Gravity will both be acquiring the plant and also making those necessary reinvestments to make sure that this asset and the legacy that's been left to us continues for decades and hopefully a century again. So I invite you to take a look at that article. It's very technical, but the pictures are neat. So this is the plant. You see here, this is the Seneca River. The water flows from, as you're viewing it, from left to right. This area down here is the canal lock. This is route, the route escapes me, but runs north-south. And then this bypass here is the main course of the river, and that runs through the plant. It's important to note these plants are called run-of-river plants, and that's an important distinction because we think about the Hoover Dam and those types of projects that you've seen out west. We're not storing the water. So we have to use the water as it flows by, run of river. And most plants in the Northeast are run of river, in part because in the Northeast, unlike out west where water rights, you actually need to have ownership of the water in order to use it. Here we get to use the water, but we can't hold it. We have to use it as it goes by. This is the powerhouse here. Here's a close-up shot of it. So the water comes down the river, hits this powerhouse, and goes through this is the generator, which you saw in the opening slide, seen in sketch form. The water comes through here, through the turbine, which is the part that spins and captures the energy from the water. It turns this shaft, which spins this generator, and it generates electricity. Seems pretty mundane based on our technology today, but back in 1916, it was pretty magical. So this plant located in Waterloo, there's some other ancillary benefits, one of which is that, you know, this is a job, this is a plant that employs local people, not just for construction, but for operation every day. This plant and the Seneca plant that's downstream, which we'll be acquiring as part of this, employ about 4.5 FTEs. The Waterloo plant, as we discussed earlier, about two-thirds of the county's electricity, or 3.8 million kilowatt hours. The plant is operating, and that's important. We're not building something new. There isn't the same construction risk that you would have for building something like a solar farm or a wind turbine. We do have our other challenges, but the fact is that on day one, this plant is actually operating, and that removes a lot of the risk for all parties. And ultimately, you know, this is about a partnership and a mutual commitment so that we can preserve and protect the legacy that was originally built for us over 100 years ago. Here's some photos. The photo here on the top left was taken just a few weeks ago. You can see it's exactly the same equipment. One piece that has one part of this project that has changed considerably are the controls. So if you look in the 1916 photo, you can see these analog controls here, this whole wall of controls. Very, very simple. Most adjustments were made manually based on human observation at the time and everyone's sort of gut instinct. The controls for this plant were updated in recent years. We'll be making additional improvements to the controls that will allow even more constant monitoring and optimization. This is one of the areas where we're able to increase production based on the historic technology, but it's still using the same basic technology. We're just running it better and smarter. So to summarize the benefits of this project, the county is investing zero capital in this project. Gravity is providing all the capital. There's no land requirement. The land is obviously part of the project acquisition. The estimated average annual savings are going to be about $39,000. Which adds up to about $750,000 over the 20-year term of the agreement. The term, the initial term of the project in which we based all the economics on is 20 years. That grandfathering that I mentioned earlier allows for up to 25 years of enjoying that grandfathering status, and so there is an option to renew and extend at the 20-year mark, which, you know, the benefits of that monetary crediting are not likely to be available in the future. So to preserve that benefit, I think it meets everybody's interests to be able to have that conversation in 20 years. No land, no state grants, no federal tax credits. All of this is being privately funded. And then one other benefit that is often forgotten is that these plants not only provide economic benefit to the end customer and the owners, but we're also spending a considerable amount of money in the local economy. And for every one, this is a 2-megawatt project. On average, for every 1 megawatt of installed capacity at small hydro in upstate New York, there's between $50,000 and $100,000 in additional spending in the form of salaries, taxes, and local spending and subcontractors, et cetera. And then finally, we get back to the original driving goal of this project, which is the environmental benefits. So this project is estimated to produce about 63% of the county's electricity. That's equivalent to 2,600 metric tons of carbon, avoided carbon, each year, which goes a long way to both practically reducing the county's carbon impact, but also sending a clear message that it's important. along with this project, all of the current and future environmental attributes, their RECs, renewable energy certificates, are one way that those are conveyed. All of those attributes are being conveyed to the county as part of this arrangement. And that's important because having those attributes, those certificates, that is what allows you to brag about your commitment to the environment. And so those are definitely part of this transaction that are being conveyed to the county, which is roughly equivalent to the generation, which is $38.50 per year. Now, one interesting side note is that those RECs are becoming more valuable. You know, the value is relatively low today. The state is creating a marketplace where these RECs can be bought and sold and traded. If the projections follow the neighboring areas like New England and Pennsylvania and New Jersey, those RECs are going to have somewhere between $25,000 and $100,000 of value moving forward. We can't really predict exactly what it is. We just know that it is likely to be worth something. So while the intent of the county is to keep those bragging rights in the future because they're titled to you, you will have the option of monetizing them if you were to choose. So there's some flexibility built into this transaction. And so that is a summary of the overall project. And unless there's Jonathan, is there anything you'd like to add?
I'd like to open it up for questions and comments, if we may. Peter Stein.
Thanks, Mike. This is the first I've heard about this, and so there's something that I'm a little bit mixed up about. Before Gravity and Mega came alive, what was the water doing? Was the water generating electric power a year ago or 2 years ago, or had it been shut off a long time ago and then got rebuilt?
Well, that is an excellent question, and in the world of small hydro in upstate New York, we see both ends of the spectrum. We are working on projects that have been severely damaged by Hurricane Irene, for example, that have been inoperable and require significant reinvestment and construction. In the Waterloo case, this project has been running almost constantly since it was first commissioned in 1916.
So then what is it that Cornell or Gravity put into it? It's made more efficient now, or hasn't changed the amount of water that's coming through, presumably? So
No. These projects are a combination of hardware, the generators, the equipment, electrical switchgear, and then the civil works, you know, the canalway, the dam itself, the powerhouse, and so on. All of that requires maintenance over time. Some projects are maintained better than others, in part because this project was originally built by a utility to provide a base load for a local utility. This is a very well-built plant. It is still old. And so upgrades and catching up on deferred maintenance is something that is always an issue for plants that we acquire. But then, of course, as you alluded to, upgrading the control packages and those things that will improve operation without necessarily switching out the equipment.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jim Dennis.
I heard Cornell mentioned, and I would want everyone to understand, Cornell is no way involved in this project. They have their own hydropower plant. This is a
That is correct. The Waterloo plant is specifically the generation from the Waterloo plant is very specifically going just to the Tompkins County.
Back in the 70s, Cornell rehabbed their plant that they'd had for many years to get back into the hydropower generating business somewhere in the late 70s. So,
Anna.
Just a quick question. Was this plant or facility, was it up for sale, or did you approach them? I'm just curious how that happened that this was available?
I'll answer that generally. These plants, especially the smaller ones, have been suffering for the last decade or so because of volatile energy prices, deferred maintenance catching up with them, et cetera. So, we didn't go on Craigslist for this, but the reality is most of these projects are, quote unquote, for sale, but you have to call.
Got it. Thanks.
Carol?
I think Dan had his hand up first.
Go ahead.
No? Right. Okay. So I want to thank you for coming here. I met whoever was the first person at Gravity after you became Gravity at the NYSAC conference long enough ago. I don't know.
That was me. And
that was you.
Yeah, okay. And I do recognize you, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, hi.
Hi.
I'm going to say only facetiously, I urged you then to please come to Tompkins County, make us the first place you operate. My question is, what took you so long? As I heard about this, which was before we were talking about energy in any kind of a big way, other than the very first of the solar panels going up. In our county, with all of the hydro that we have here, it seemed to, and the consciousness we have about it, it seemed to me to really make sense. So I'm very glad that you're here. I have two questions. One is just whether this will be a portion of the power that we already are under contract with Mega versus a new purchase?
That's an excellent question. And because the credit that you'll be receiving comes in a dollar format, you will continue to purchase electricity at the same level, same pricing, same volume as you're currently purchasing through Mega. What you'll be getting in addition to that is basically a credit which serves as sort of a monthly coupon that you'll be applying to your Mega electric bill to reduce it, in addition to the bragging rights and the environmental attributes associated with the project. So this is not about reducing the volume that you purchase from Mega as much as it is about generating a modest revenue to reduce that Mega bill that you get on a monthly basis.
Okay, thank you. And then the other question I had, first an apology. I'm sorry, I didn't recognize you from way down at the end of the room in the dark there, so I'm sorry that I didn't
I don't think I had a beard.
Okay. okay, and the other one is, at the time, I think New York State was talking about the ability, and again, this was before you were up and operating, I believe, New York State was talking about allowing the ability for smaller scale hydro, even than this, to come online. So if, for example, there was an old existing little dam in my backyard, and the stream in my backyard, that I'd be able to put that back into service, or if there were a farmer, say, who had a suitable place, that they'd be able to do that as well. I don't remember whether that would be under remote net metering and you could sort of sell the power to your neighbor or not. When you say that the law has changed, is it just the remote net metering portion of it, or can this serve as an example, should we do a lot of publicity, to people here to put these old, already dammed spots? And I understand that's very different than not already dammed spots, but back online.
Yeah, the law that changed was how that credit is applied to your bill. And so under the mechanism that we'll be using for your project, that credit will be coming in the form of a dollar, which is definitely to your advantage. Moving forward, projects can still remotely net meter, but they'll be receiving a credit in the form of a kilowatt hour, a volumetric. But your broader question about how does this, you know, what's the example that's being set here? The example that's being set, I think, is very much in line with what you're talking about, is that we as society, we like to build new. There are a lot of great innovative new technologies, but we've already gone through several periods of innovation, and this is an example of one of those periods 100 years ago. That resource, that asset that was built, that society subsidized to build 100 years ago, it is financially more efficient to refurbish and reuse something that's already been built than it is to build something new. Now, your question about the little mill in the backyard, that type of thing, that's a pretty complex area of law. And, you know, just as an example, we all know how difficult it is to build something next to wetlands, and the jurisdictions and hoops that you have to jump through there. That's part of that is one of the barriers to the type of project that I think you were alluding to, but projects that are currently licensed, whether they're operating or not, are great candidates for this type of redevelopment work.
I've got Dan, and then I'll let Peter have a second chance, and Martha, and then let's please, we need to wrap this up. Dan?
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that when we say that this hydro project is going to supply 60-something percent of electricity, Tompkins County's electricity, we don't mean Tompkins County. We don't mean all the houses in the county. We mean Tompkins County government. We mean this building and the other facilities that we operate. Most people probably knew that. I just think it was worth saying.
Peter?
Looking at that, I was wondering whether this is any kind of a tourist destination. I'd love to see a 100-year-old electric power plant.
And once we've completed the acquisition, we would love to host an event there with you. Conveniently, that area that you can see in this image here, the area along the canal is actually owned by the Canal Corporation, and that is a little park area that is publicly accessible. I think it's a tourist destination.
Good, I'll go. Thank you.
Martha?
Yeah, I agree, Peter, and I think the locks are fascinating too. So. I have two questions. One is all the other blue water drops on here. I'm wondering how many are on the map that you showed. Here's the small version. How many of those do you think will end up being, refurbished and put back in, or how many are continuing to serve? And then you just talked about the credit will be in the form of kilowatt hours, not dollars. You told the committee that the policy that was being changed, that we were grandfathered into the original, was that the value that the utility will pay to us is close to retail price, and that was what was deemed sort of unbeneficial, and now the price, going forward, the price will be closer to wholesale. So the utility will still charge... Not us, because, as you said, we're grandfathered in. So if this happens in the future, the utility will charge retail and give a credit for essentially wholesale. Is that correct?
Generally, yes. One way to look at it is that the difference between the wholesale and the retail price, that delta, 2 cents or whatever it is, 3 cents, it's those 2 or 3 cents that the Public Service Commission is saying the customer shouldn't get that. Somebody has to pay that. We don't know who's paying it, but, it's just they called it economic arbitrage or unintended economic arbitrage is how they defined it. But yes, that's generally correct. They're reducing the value to the customer by that delta.
So So I was glad when you told the committee that you and others were planning to form an Empire State Hydro Association to start lobbying to maybe try to encourage the Public Utility Corporation to see, Public Service Commission to see that in a slightly more balanced way. I mean, when you look at all these blue dots that might be hydro plants, if there's no economic value that's recognizable out of putting that capital in to restart these plants or upgrade the ones that are still working, then they're not going to go into service, or they're not going to stay in service for any period of time. And since the Public Service Commission is supposed to be working for the public, I think, that is the only way. You have to, there has to be an economic logic to making those investments.
And they are, through this REV process, there are several mechanisms being debated and studied that will seek to do that in a much broader way than that monetary crediting mechanism. But the other piece that's so critical, which this project is demonstrating, it's the long-term commitment to purchasing the output that's so important to us, because that allows us to justify these ongoing large investments and know that we have a predictable revenue stream, just as you'll know that you have a predictable, more predictable electricity cost.
Jonathan, did you want to make
a comment? If I can just say, as things move along, if there's any way to lobby with you on that issue, that's something that I think this body would be eager to support.
And we would welcome it.
Jonathan, did you want to make a comment?
Actually, I was going to kind of volunteer to try to explain the difference between monetary net metering and volumetric, but maybe I'll make it more complicated.
Please,
so maybe,
don't.
Maybe Omai's,
I'd love to hear that at some point.
I'd like to say that this is one more example of where Tompkins County is a leader,
yes,
and
are.
Is out in front. And what better way to generate electricity for our needs than by water power, one of the oldest methods of using power in history. And we're pleased to have this partnership going forward. But it is typical Tompkins County. And those folks that don't think we're doing enough in Tompkins County, take a look around us. We're doing more than a lot of places are. And I do want to nod to Seneca County, our sister county. Maybe it's state-imposed, but this is also intermunicipal cooperation. The plant is located in Waterloo, Village of Waterloo, in Seneca County. They get some benefits here. No doubt there are jobs associated with running this plant, which I think is terrific. So we get some good from it, and they get some good from it, and the people of the area get the reduction in the carbon. So I wanted to say that. Jim, I see you had your hand.
Yes. Let's
wrap
Mike, wonderful comments about Tompkins County. I wanted to just remind people, professor, legislator, community leader Stuart Stein, Barbara Blanchard, Jonathan Wood, many years. You know, we've had two meetings, 2.5 hours maybe total, and this is the culmination as we approve this of a very long time and a huge effort. So I am hoping that we can approve this. And, Mike, I would ask for a roll call vote on this.
All right. Are we ready to vote?
Yes.
The clerk will call the roll, please.
Mr. John?
Yes.
Ms. Kellis?
Yes.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Klein?
Yes.
Mrs. McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Mr. Morey?
Yes.
Ms. Robertson?
Yes.
Mr. Sigler?
Yes.
Mr. Stein?
Aye.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Mr. Lane?
Yes. Anyone want to change her or his vote? Please announce the vote.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
That's unanimous.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming and speaking with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Martha?
So we'll do a doodle poll when we can have a tour up there. And again, thank you to Jonathan, because it's the hard work of our staff behind the scenes. It's easy for us to sit here and listen to a PowerPoint presentation and when everything's all been worked out. And it's been a lot of work, and we really, really appreciate, Jonathan, that you recognize what we would care about, and you found a way to make it happen.
Well, thanks. But like Jim said, at least at first, Stu Stein was really our major promoter and leader in starting this, at least.
Thank you. We'll suspend while we put the screens up. We're going to proceed to privilege the floor for the public. I'd like to thank members of the public who are here to speak for indulging us to have that presentation. Hopefully what that was about, folks can understand how important it is for people to understand why that is important for Tompkins County and the residents of Tompkins County. Privilege of the floor is the opportunity for anyone to come and speak to us for up to 3 minutes on any topic. We ask, if you want to speak, that you please fill out one of the blue cards in the back and pass it forward. By signing the blue card, you're agreeing to the rules of the legislature. You're agreeing to the three-minute time limit, and the three-minute time limit is shown on a screen on the side. At the end of the 3 minutes, there'll be an audible alarm. It sounds like a telephone ring, and we ask that if you're still speaking that you please conclude. You're agreeing not to raise your voice. You're agreeing not to use lewd, obscene, profane, slanderous, or libelous language or speak or act in a manner that would tend to incite a breach of peace. You're agreeing not to speak about county personnel matters. Personnel matters include comments about the job performance of named county employees other than elected officials. After 3 minutes, you agree to leave the microphone and yield the floor. Transferring time to another person is not permitted. You agree that if you cause a disruption and are asked to leave, you will leave the chambers. The first card I have this evening is Frank Proto. Please state your name and your municipality.
Frank Proto, the town of Caroline. And before I lose too much time, as a member of the Erie Canal Commission and a commissioner appointed by the Department of the Interior, I'd appreciate a copy of that presentation.
Frank, of course, is a former member of this legislature. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm here this evening to talk about the minimum wage proposal. This body passed the resolution back at the end of last year and was very supportive of lending support to the agencies in town. I'm concerned not about whether it passes or not, but about the potential for unintended consequences. I want to bring to your attention the amount of effort that many of us spent around this very table and with various committee assignments about building the network of agencies, particularly healthcare, that we have in this community. And I'm concerned about the devastation that it may cause to some of these agencies, not only because of loss of money, but loss of services that translates into a loss to the community. So I want to urge you, please, the Senate and the Assembly passed their versions of the budget just recently, within the last day or so. I would like to ask you to pass another resolution reminding them that they need to do more to make sure that, for as an instance, the Medicaid reimbursement rate be changed and increased to compensate these agencies that are going to get hurt. Otherwise, the county ought to be ready to step in and make up the difference, which I would imagine would be a tough sell with the current taxing situation. So I want to thank you for the effort you put forward in the past and urge you that be happy to help in any way I can. Last item, universal fund, just one dig. Please go back and read your utility bills. We're getting blitzed again, and no, I'm disappointed that no one has picked up the consumer advocacy piece regarding this particular issue, except David has consented to be the contact person. We're getting hit again on our utility bills for not just the universal fund, but a universal fund surcharge. Now, figure that one out. I've asked that already to my telephone provider, and they don't know the answer to it. Thank you very much. I'm very concerned about the minimum wage. Have a good evening. Enjoy the weather. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. William Russin, please.
Well, first, good evening, and thank you for the opportunity to talk in front of this august deliberative body. I just wanted to give some real example life to what Frank talked about, which is there is a deep, profound reality to if we all of a sudden were required to pay a $15 minimum wage, Cayuga Addiction Recovery Services, as you know it, would cease to exist. Okay? And I believe that this community needs and wants the services that Cayuga Addiction Recovery Services provides, as has been seen by developments over the last several years, especially in regards to heroin. But there is a deep reality, there's been comments made about the fact that, well, it's going to be phased in. Well, my unfortunate response to that is I haven't seen neither a Medicaid increase nor a state aid increase for a really long time. So I don't have any confidence whatsoever that any of that is going to change. So you can phase it in, but we're still going to be at the same point year one, year two, year three, year four, year five. It really doesn't matter. So there's just a deep, significant reality to this that's going to mean organizations like mine, and all I'm going to speak about is mine. And I know Mr. Brown was on the radio a week after I was, or a week before I was on WHCU, talking about this issue earlier in the year. And Francisco Racker Center is in exactly the same situation I am. There are certain entry-level positions and support positions that can, at this, in our present matrix of how we are supported by the fees that we generate through the services we do and the state aid that provides charity pool for the people that can't afford to pay for our services, that matrix, that infrastructure is not going to significantly change. And that is going to devastate an organization like mine. So I just ask you to take that into consideration. Nobody is against a $15 minimum wage. Bill Russin sure isn't. As a guy that started at $2.11 an hour as an orderly in a nursing home, I got nothing against $15 an hour. However, the reality is there a lot of accommodations and a lot of other resources have to come to bear before that becomes a reality. So thank you very much, and I appreciate your time and your forbearance. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. Sherry Corthus.
Hi. Oh, darn. I'm Sherry Corthus in Ithaca, and I think you guys probably got my email because I had spoken about this grant submission application that you guys approved November, I think at the 16th is the Public Safety Committee and the 17th Legislature, and you approved it, and I'd asked that it be, that if we were going to go forward with this merger, because I don't think it's a good idea, that you would keep the public transparent in the whole process. And then so last Tuesday, well, 2 weeks ago on March 1st, I read in the Ithaca Voice the next day that you guys held a vote on the grant submission because the deadline was March 15th. So then I have some questions that if you guys would answer. So was the grant application submitted today? And then if so, what are the agencies or the departments that participated? I know it's Cayuga Heights, Dryden, Village of Groton, and Cornell. And how long before we know if we get the grant, when we get the grant, how long the study is, when it begins, when it ends. And I was a business manager for 13 years at a medical center, and I worked in basic science for 7 years. And I know the way a grant usually works is you apply for the grant, and you go through all that, and you receive the money, you conduct your research, and then you implement what you've done. So, my concern is that this whole process is going to happen in no public. I'm the only public here speaking about it because nobody I talk to knows about it. But, I mean, again, we already have mutual aid agreements. I just don't see merging. And I don't know that the Ithaca police themselves want to go out into, you know, the county and patrol the county. They like patrolling the downtown area because they feel connected to the downtown area. But the transparency is a big issue for me because I'd asked that it be transparent. And this was approved, like I said, on November 17th. So I guess that's an issue. And I just wanted to express my, you know, I guess I'm upset about it. And that's what I can say. And I would appreciate some questions that I really would answered. Like, I don't want this just to happen like the jail expansion did. It just Zoom, and there's nothing we can do, and then we have a big military department, and, you know, they already get the Homeland Security money, and they get all these toys and stuff, and militarization of the police department is not the way to go. I think it's better in our human interest is to be a community that cares about one another, has community policing. You know, I don't think mixing these together, even the study, is, to me, not a good idea. But thank you for listening to me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We normally don't respond to privilege of the floor. However, I think if you have some time when we get to the report by the county administrator, he would bring us up to date on that application process. That's the last the privilege of the floor I have from the public. I have a municipal official who I want to turn to next if there's no one else. I'd like to invite, yes, I've got Deborah. Oh, ducks! I didn't see you back there. Okay. Well, I've got Deborah first because she actually filled out a card. She didn't have to, but Deborah Cipolla Dennis, councilwoman from the town of Dryden. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks, Mike. I always want to follow the rules, so I filled out a card. I just wanted to bring you up to date a little bit on what's happening in Dryden. We do have a meeting coming up this Thursday. And at that meeting, we'll be considering two special use permits that have been in the works for a while. One is for a storage facility on Route 13 and at 1401 Dryden Road, and then another one that is for a housing project at 902 Dryden Road in Varna. All of the documents are finally finished, so we will be voting on those issues. We're also looking at a zoning law amendment to help with define our density in our rural residential areas because that was confusing and was actually preventing some developers from moving forward with some projects. What we're really trying to do is to simplify our zoning law and to make the process of applying for a special use permit or site plan review easier for developers, and we're hoping to stimulate some activity there. We also have a preliminary site plan review coming up at the planning board, which is on the 28th, for a housing project that will be located at Freeze Road and Dryden Road in Varna. And so we're trying to stimulate more housing, and that will be affordable housing, so that's a good project. Let's see what else. We will be considering a resolution asking our federal representatives to oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership, sort of modeled after the one that you guys passed. Those are the big things that are coming up. I really enjoyed the presentation on the remote net metering. That's a great project, and actually I'm going to leave this meeting and actually go to a meeting that's at the space talking about solar, community solar for municipalities. So we're trying to do similar things in Dryden, is that so? Thank you.
Thanks so much, Deborah. We really appreciate your taking your time to come and tell us about Dryden. Duxton? From the City Council.
Hi.
Welcome.
Duxton, Second Ward, Ithaca. So I think you know about Leslin and the county city stuff, like the law enforcement consolidation and the Six Mile Creek conservation easement. We also have some kind of transformative public works projects going on. I know you know about Tioga Street and the bike lanes that are being proposed. They talked about it yesterday, and they're going to talk about it again on March 28th with a target decision date of April 11th, I believe. Then there's two projects in the West End that are pretty big. Brinley Street, which will reconfigure the way Deganic Boulevard goes through that area. And there's some thought about how to change West State Street to make it more bike and pedestrian friendly, including potentially reducing it to three lanes and having like a center turn lane. And the rest of the action is occurring on, most of the action is occurring in Planning and Development Committee. So a couple weeks ago, the Chainworks team came to present to us, and they have like a schedule going forward. And just yesterday, the draft general environmental impact study is out. You can get that at chainworksdistrict.com. There's an event on March 29th at Cinemopolis, 5:30 to 6:30, open to the public that you might be interested in. Also, the council as a whole passed what we call temporary mandatory planned unit development for the waterfront, which basically just gives us a little bit of oversight. And we recently got our first application, which is the Cherry Street Art Space. It's just a small theater where Renova's Energy used to be. And we, or at least I, anticipate that McGuire will be applying soon as well for their proposed project near the community gardens. And the other big topics at planning are CTAP. So we're heading in a direction, because there are so many kind of conflicting desires for, for community benefits, we are headed towards a community benefit fund where the developer would pay into a fund. And so staff is working out those details. Right now we're leaning towards a 1% 10-year abatement, the details of which you can find on the agenda from our meeting last week. I anticipate that this will still be a multi-month discussion. So we just got past discussing that, and we're going to spend a lot of time on local labor and sustainability and other things. And the other big thing that is coming up that we discussed is incentive zoning, which is distinct from inclusionary zoning in that it will be voluntary. This would be some incentives to get developers to include affordable housing units in their projects or make a payment in lieu of. So that's all I've got.
Thank you. Got a couple questions for you, it looks like. Will Burbank.
Dr. Nice seeing you. Thank you for that. You covered a lot of territory. I had about 10 questions, but I'll limit it to two. The Brinley Street, what is the time scale on that, and do you have funding for that?
Part of the funding is not yet in place, but it's anticipated, the state part, and I forget the percentage. And I also forget the timeline off the top of my head,
okay.
But it's 2018 completion, roughly.
And I was a little confused when you were talking about the new theater on Cherry Street, because I was aware that in the old Renovus that it's recently was occupied by youth advocates of Tompkins County, is this a different building?
As far as I know, they're renovating that building, so I actually don't know if there's a current tenant.
Well, they have a sign up, so maybe a different building or whatever, but in any case.
Could be, but it's the same area.
Yeah, thank you.
Carol?
Can you tell me the dates again for the parking, the bike lane decision?
Right, so they wanted public comment by yesterday, but I'm sure they'll take more going forward. They'll probably talk about it again at the next March 28th meeting, and April 11th is the target decision date.
Okay, and I understand, can I talk about this? I understand that at one of the public meetings, the notion was raised of freeing up spaces in our county lot near the courthouse by having county employees who currently park there park in the city parking garage. And I wondered if you knew if the city is proposing that we trade spots in any way so that the city would be providing spots equivalent to those that they're asking us to free up?
I don't know offhand. I did hear third hand that someone had brought this up, but I don't know about anything formal.
Okay, thank you.
Martha?
I want to thank Dan for having gone to that meeting and Mike for having written a letter about this parking issue on Tioga Street. And my comment back would be that, and I hope you'll share this, it doesn't make any sense to me to have bike lanes on Cayuga Street kind of stop and then somehow pick up on Tioga Street. That's kind of not particularly good planning in any way. You know, you've got people headed downtown, and suddenly the bike lanes disappear, and I don't know, they're supposed to just know that they're supposed to go left and pick up a lane on Tioga. So that's one issue. And I think it really is, it would really be nice if decision-making could somehow be a little more collaborative. I mean, I feel like with the mayor's drug policy recently, that was also a little bit lacking as far as the county's role in services for alcohol and drug policy. It's not a great, style, I guess. So I think some real problems with that proposal. I think that we really need a coherent bike strategy, and I think continuing down Cayuga Street, especially because you've got one way, it might make more sense just to do that. I think I appreciate Dan bringing that up.
Jim?
Dustin, thank you for coming over. I, too, read the email that Dan had, and all that discussion took place in the Board of Public Works, and I thought very interesting that they wanted to swap spaces with us. Much of our parking lot is controlled by New York State court system in the sense that if we ever said we're going to give places away or swap, they will fill it up with their employees. And the other thing that I was interested in was that I've been on the IDA 4 years, 5 years, and almost every project we approve downtown has no parking requirement, but they're pointed to different parking structures. Well, that's where they're going to go. That's where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty interesting to me that all of a sudden there's these vacant spaces that we're going to go into. And, it's just a comment from the county as a former city council person who struggled with parking for 13 years. So,
Anna?
Just a few quick dates. The March 28th meeting is for the bikes. Where is that?
It's just a regular BPW meeting in council chambers. To Martha's point, real quick, the bike boulevard preceded me. However, my understanding is the bike boulevard, it connects to the Cascadale Ave portion of it, which is not complete, connects to those Cayuga Street bike lanes. And the bike boulevard, and so there is some issue here with putting bike lanes in Tiger Street, because the point of the bike boulevard was not necessarily to as my understanding of it, reading through the plan, is that these are already kind of low traffic areas where we can put in sharrows, the shared arrows, and not necessarily put in bike lanes, and then connect them to higher traffic areas like Cayuga Street, where there are explicit dedicated bike lanes. I understand your concern, but there is a plan to connect Cascadale Avenue, the diagonal portion between Tioga and Cayuga.
Martha and Carol both want to speak again, then we want to let Dustin go.
Yeah, I'll let the parking issue go and just thank you, Dustin, for stepping up to agree to be the new city rep for the housing fund, which is very important. And J.R. Claiborne had been, as an elected official, had been a member, and now he'll be the alternate so that the city will have an elected representative on the housing fund. So thanks very much for taking that on, because it's really important.
Carol?
Yeah, I just want to thank you for coming here. You've volunteered, you show up, and we're not usually in the practice of shooting the messenger You've obviously hit a sensitive nerve. And, you know, if there's a way we could sit down and talk about this more productively, I'm certainly willing to volunteer to be one of the people who does so. And I urge you to still come to us with these issues. We don't usually jump and bite.
For sure. So the other of Martha's points is in terms of collaboration, George and I do want to come here more often and keep you apprised of things so that you can comment and let us know.
You're always welcome. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Let's go to privilege the floor for legislators. None of you want to talk, do you? Jim Dennis's hand first.
I actually do, Mike. And I'm not sure how to approach this, but I'm just going to say it anyway. I read today an email or a Facebook post from Mike Talarski about the Hainer Hoyt Construction Company, who I will add is currently the construction company Ithaca Neighborhood Housing Service is hiring to build their North Side project. And through the IDA, we were able to give them some assistance with some different things. Hainer Hoyt is on the hook for $5 million on a civil lawsuit for some things they pulled off in Onondaga County. And it's troubling to me that obviously we did not know about that when we were doing our help to Ithaca Neighborhood Housing. And it may have gone the same way, but clearly those kinds of things become an issue. We turned down a housing project on the IDA because of the name of the developer and some of the history that he had in the community. And it really is troubling to me that, you know, we in good conscience go out, do the things we do in the IDA, give grants to people, give abatements to people, and we expect that, you know, the people they hire are play by the same rules. And I'm sure INHS did not have knowledge about what happened, but this dropped today, and it's a bit troubling. I feel a little like, you know, as a IDA member, I gave something, I voted something, the rest of us did, and you know, you kind of feel like the public comes out and says, yeah, you know, here's what you've done, and there's a company on the other side that may not be, you know, they've had a wonderful reputation for many years in Central New York. They got caught up in some things, and they had to pay $5 million for a civil suit. That's kind of troubling, and we're somehow related to that.
Willie Kiefer.
Thank you. I assume that probably all of you know that yesterday was Pi Day, but in case you don't, I'm going to mention it anyway. 3.14159, yesterday was 3.1416. So there was a lot of celebration about that among certain folks. I just also want to let you know that I put in comments on the to the Board of Public Works on the bike lanes. It didn't occur to me that I should mail it to all of you, but I will try to do that so you can see what my comments were, too. I don't know whether they were read or not. You went to that meeting, Dan.
I mean, nothing was read out loud, but they must have had them.
Anna.
Eating my dinner while here in the legislative meeting. I wanted to thank you, Jim, for bringing that up. That was something that was on my mind as well. And I just wanted to add something that I found equally disturbing is they had a job fair recently for the Hancock project, and none of the contractors that were there for the job fair were represented any local companies. And so I think that there's some practices that might be worth us keeping our eye on as that proceeds. So I wanted to thank Jim again for bringing it up.
Martha.
First, a question to Dooley. Could you give us a couple sentence or one line summary of what your comments were on the? Just curious.
Well, there was more than one. One was that the plan that we have been told about off and on over several years keeps morphing, and it doesn't seem connected anymore. There had been a proposal for kind of a rectangle, and it's no longer in place, it seems to me. The actual bumps on the bike lane on Tioga Street are very poorly designed. It's listed as 25 miles an hour, but if you go 25 miles an hour over those rather abrupt bumps, your car and you suffer. Very much in contrast to the town of Ithaca's similar speed bumps on Judd Falls Road, which they did several years ago, which are timed for 25 miles an hour and work. And I had asked the city traffic engineer if he was familiar with the Judd Falls Road ones, and he wasn't. So I am not sure who is responsible for the designing, but there are various problems with it.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to mention a couple of meetings that I've been to recently and sort of in the frame of planning and economic development. One was the sort of pitch evening, the kickoff, local kickoff for 76 West. The Rev, Ithaca Startup Program, did a great event at the, now maybe this is obvious why it was successful, it was at Ithaca Beer on, you know, at 6 o'clock one night. Why would that be predicted to be a win? But there were, I don't know, like 150 people there, just and not the people we usually see, but people so involved in different kinds of startups and economic development. It was really fun. Lots. I mean, I felt considerably older than I usually do. It was definitely a young crowd. So it just made me really believe there's a lot going on, and we're not necessarily aware of it. But this community really has a tremendous amount of creativity and entrepreneurial activity that's happening right now. So that was very, very exciting. And thanks to Megan McDonald, who suggested I go to a lecture at Cornell, which I did last Friday, on community level sustainability, local government actions on regional and global issues. And it was presented by a professor at Binghamton University named George Homsey. And he's been looking at what do local governments do around the country about sustainability and economic development. Well, they've done a survey of city managers, and so clearly it's sort of, that survey was obviously cities and villages, and found that 31% of those have a sustainability plan, which was seemed pretty high, actually 31%. But the top priority in most of those has to do with a focus on economic development. So that's kind of interesting. He also pointed out that in the country as a whole, most of the population lives in smaller municipalities, like with fewer than 50,000 people. And those municipalities really don't have sustainability plans or even comprehensive plans. I mean, it's something like in the teens with the number of municipalities around the country that, when you look at the population size where most people live, planning doesn't really take on the kind of role that it does with us. So I think it's another area where I think Tompkins County is ahead of the curve, where we are. Obviously, as a county, we're larger than 50,000, but the city is smaller, and I think there's and other towns around in the county also have serious comprehensive plans and in many cases sustainability plans as well. So I think that it's something to be aware of, that in a lot of places attention, even in 2016, is not being paid to the kinds of issues that we talk about a lot. So just wanted to let you know.
Will?
Thanks, Mike. Jim, thanks for bringing that email to our attention. I too was a little disturbed to read it, but I have a very different take, as you might expect, than you do. I also have been on the IDA for a number of years. We don't normally, as we approve abatements, are not aware of who the contractors are going to be. And as you know, we have
struggle with the question, can we build into our system some consideration of use of local labor and encouraging certain kinds of employers? And I hope we, on the idea, will continue. And you also cited an example where you said somebody had been not denied on the basis of their name. I have to really disagree with you on that. I know why I voted, which was that particular, if it's the case we're talking about or thinking about, it was a case where it was sufficient deficiency in the application and the energy standards. And I think there was a very good basis for turning that down. We don't normally turn down on the basis of a name.
Mike Sigler.
I wanted to be quick, and thank you all, really, for signing on to that, to get some money, hopefully, from the state for the power plant if it does eventually close. I wanted to bring this up, too, though, because I really feel during that whole debate about that, a lot of people who are against the power plant talked about that as if, there's money set aside. I was in a meeting this week, and it was like, you would literally have to lose 20% of your tax base to kind of get into that money, and that really surprised me. 20% is just enormous. You're talking about basically the nuclear power plants going out, and that's who's going to be in line to get this money. So, you know, I hear people talking about, well, we're going to increase that amount of money, or we're going to try to do $50 million instead of $19 million. Great. So now we're not going to be eligible for $50 million as opposed to $19 million. And I will say that our assemblywoman is working to get that percentage down, and I hope she's successful, and anything we can do to help her do that would be great. But I really felt that was kind of like just a disingenuous kind of argument by some of the people who wanted that closed. And I want to say, too, that every time something like this happens, people say, well, we should put money aside to retrain these people. And I said this in the meeting, too. Retrain these people to do what? Exactly. I hear that all the time as if that's some kind of panacea, like we're going to send them to training. You're talking about people who have worked at a power plant for 30 years. We're not retraining them. This is what they do. So I think it's just interesting because I'm going to be talking about this tomorrow, and I've been thinking about it a lot. You know, when we question why certain politicians rise and are continuing to rise in this country, it's because of those jobs that are going out. Those people are angry because, once again, we're saying, your job really isn't all that important. Those 74 jobs, we don't know what you're going to do, but, frankly, we don't really care either. And I just can't stress enough how bothersome that is to me. So just a couple ideas there. Thanks.
Dave McKenna.
Thank you, Mike. I'd just like to bring up a couple upcoming events. One happens to be in Lansing. Somewhere between the 9th and the 23rd of April, there'll be a tire collection deal sponsored by Tompkins County Soil and Water. The exact date has not been set yet, so I'll advise you at the next meeting, hopefully. The other is if you're looking for cheap entertainment and a really good time, go out to Newfield next weekend and watch the Disney production of High School Musical. The kids do an excellent job. I don't have the exact times. You'll have to call a school to get them, but I went last weekend, and it's fabulous. Thank you.
Question for Dave. What is tire collection? What is
a
tire collection?
You have old tires laying around, you know, like not on rims or on rims even. The Soil and Water sponsors a collection. It's usually done once a year, and you can bring them to the collection point, which is going to be at the town barns in Lansing.
Great. Thank you.
Dave, will there be a limit on the number that people can bring? Or?
I don't know of any limit. I have not heard of any limit so far. I don't think there is one, do you, Jim?
No, there wasn't. There was not last year.
Rich John.
Thank you. I'm not in the habit of getting up here and talking about personal items, but I was really gratified by the proclamation regarding organ donation. It was 21 years ago my mother passed away, and it was a, not surprisingly, a very hard, sad time. One of the real comforts was she became an organ donor, and there were three people who got the benefit of that. One of them, it clearly saved their life, So I just throw it out there that if you've been procrastinating about going to the DMV and getting that heart on your license, you know, get down there. Do it. It's a wonderful thing when you know you've made that decision and you're ready to help somebody. Thanks.
Thank you, Rich. Leslie McBean, Claiborne.
Thank you, Rich. I do have my heart on my license. And I wasn't sure how I was going to top Dave with, you know, cheap and whatever entertainment. My mind was going all kinds of places, Dave, at any rate.
It was intentional.
I know you very well. I know it was intentional. Happy Women's History Month. It's March. We celebrate a lot during the month of March, but we also celebrate the achievements past and yet to come by our women folk. Congrats to all the women who sit on this body for your years of service here and serving the public. Today, Martha and I and others who I might not have seen attended the Community Foundation Women's Fund Luncheon. And I want to give a big old shout out to Phoebe Brown, who was the recipient of the Laura Holmberg Award at this event. Phoebe spoke very well about just her life, where she's been, where she came from, and why she's here, her purpose for being here. And it was quite moving to hear some of her story. So I do want to, again, congratulate Phoebe from the legislature level on receiving this award. It was well-deserved. I also want to mention that 2 days from now, Friday, is the annual Sister Friends Luncheon that is sponsored by the Multicultural Resource Center and a number of other community agencies, another event where we celebrate intergenerational women. It's an intergenerational event where we celebrate women and girls and all that they have been doing, achieving, and working towards in our communities and beyond. It is at Emerson Suites at Ithaca College. I'm sure it's sold out because it usually is. This year, our guest speaker is a native of our community, Dr. Nia Nunn, who grew up here in Ithaca and now teaches at Ithaca College and has a story to tell. So if you did not get your ticket, sorry, I can't promise there are any, and I can't sneak you in as the speaker at our luncheon today talked about. But I also do want to acknowledge that the county has been involved with this event in tabling around employment opportunities with the county, even if we don't have any open jobs, but just being there and sharing with people the option of working in government. And it is lucrative and it is rewarding. So we're very thankful for that. So, again, I just wanted to mention those two things and say Happy Women's History Month. I know there's a Connie Coke documentary, but I couldn't remember the date and time of it, so I didn't mention it. But look it up. It's online.
Thank you all. Before we move to staff reports, let's see if we can get a couple of our staff people taken care of here tonight. Dave, you've got a resolution D on facilities and infrastructure, and I wondered if we could move to that and if you might move that resolution.
Very much. Okay, this is document ID 6184, determination of a negative declaration of environmental significance in relation to reconstruction of the Red Mill Road Bridge, over Fall Creek in the town of Dryden, locally funded.
Seconded by Glenn Morey. Discussion. Martha Robertson.
I have a couple of questions. What's for Jeff? Maybe for Jeff.
Jeff Smith, could you come to a microphone, please?
You see, in our memo, it's packet page 11. It says construction will start in summer 2016. Is this a one or two summer thing?
That is the plan to start this year. It is a two-year project. The nice part about it is the Red Mill Bridge is closed. and so the impact to traffic is nil. If we can start that project this year, get all the way done or partway done, and then finish it next year, and then when that bridge is open and open to traffic, then they would go to the Mallaryville Road and process and rehab that. So it's a two-year project. Any way you slice it, and it is in design and hoping to start this year.
Okay. And I'm glad the town is going to take the bridge and figure out something to do with it.
Yeah, that worked out really well.
Yeah.
Yep.
And when you make this whole thing about SHPO, about documentation of the bridge, I hope you'll make and keep a third copy somehow in the county files, because all these photographs that you have to take.
Yeah, it's been compared to a wedding album. It's actually pretty involving, very specific, all the elements that have to be encompassed in that project file for that, to preserve that. So, yeah, we can make two copies of that.
Okay, thanks.
Carol.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks. Don't go away, Jeff.
Okay, I'm not.
It may be buried in here, and I couldn't find it. How many vehicles a day do you anticipate will be using this bridge?
That's a difficult question. I'd have to go back to when it was last open and then kind of extrapolate from there. I don't know, and I don't want to guess, but I know that it was closed in 2006, and prior to that closing, it was posted, and the weight limit on it was lowered. So even in the final years of the bridge being open, there was very low volume of traffic on that bridge, mostly because of the load restriction. I think everyone here probably knows the area pretty well. It's a rural area. There is going to be some use. There will be likely a relief of vehicles going through the Mallaryville area that are going there now. A lot of the fire departments and school buses and things are very happy to see this happen, so they don't have to go through the narrow one-lane bridge at Mallaryville and through that little hamlet where all the houses are. I don't have a good number. I could get that to you. I could look back and see what the numbers were in 2006 and try and give you an idea. I can definitely tell you what the traffic was then, but I don't know off the top of my head right now.
Yeah, no, I'd be interested, sure, in hearing. And then the other question, from back in the days when I was on the F&I committee, we heard a lot about our road policy, our highway policy, and we have a whole system for our roads in rating the condition and putting projects in the queue for attention, following them closely about, you know, to figure out when they should rise to the top of that queue, when they get to a condition. So essentially we have a road policy, a road upgrade and rebuilding refurbishment policy. And we had talked about the need to eventually do that with bridges as well, to figure out a more systematic way. Are we doing anything towards that? Has anything happened towards that yet?
Our call for projects, our qualifying bridges are done through a competitive process, through our TIP, through our MPO, the ITCTC, as these projects get on and are brought in and evaluated through projects throughout the region and the county. These are locally funded projects. These were put on the capital plan by my predecessors and were agreed to by the rest of the people in this room. As we add projects, I can speak to them and I can speak to their value. This is a project that's been on the capital. This specific project has been on the capital plan for quite some time, as I realize. The project for Mallaryville has been on the plan. The region and the town and the area really wants to see it happen the way that we're planning on replacing the Red Mill Bridge and then preserving the Mallaryville Bridge within the budget that's set aside for that capital project. As these as we move forward and we pick projects, they're evaluated on their value, and they're given that funding and that strength through our capital plan and bonding.
Was any reevaluation done after we made the decision to spend all that money on the nearby bridge? Because if it hasn't been, I will have trouble voting for this.
What do you mean reevaluation?
Well, as we did at the time that this bridge was put on the list, we were talking about not rebuilding the other nearby bridge.
As I understand it, the Red Mill Bridge has gone through many different alternatives and design and work to obtain funding for many years prior to today. That's the history there. They've worked to through various phases of projects. We've asked for funding from state and a lot of different sources. So it's really been a priority to replace the bridge. I think the local, you know, the town of Dryden is behind it. The people at the public information meeting were behind it. I'm not sure that it's really lost any interest or excuse me, meaningful, you know, value to see transportation improved in this area. It's declined greatly with the closing of Red Mill Bridge and the decline. There hasn't been any injection of any kind of capital in it for many years.
Thank you.
Okay, I've got Martha from, and then I've got Dooley. Then can we proceed to a vote?
Yeah, when I first came on the legislature, so this has been going on for a long time, so 2002, this was an issue. And I went out there and talked to the farmer that's just on the other side of the bridge, the main user of the bridge, and it wasn't quite close. It wasn't closed when I first came, but that didn't last long because, you know, the total number of vehicles was low, but it's a critical piece of infrastructure for that farm operation, and it's the fact that they've had to use other routes has added miles traveled and damaged other roads when it's, this is a very simple, easy way to get from the farm operation to other land that they own and farm, as well as just to Fall Creek Road so that they can get their milk delivered and picked up and then delivered. So I think this is a wise investment, needs to be done. It is not, it's not in this case the number of vehicles so much as a critical piece of infrastructure for a very important business in our community. And I would say a bridge that's closed kind of by definition seems like the highest priority because it isn't usable anymore. And if we have a plan to use it, I mean to rehab it, to fix it, to put a new one up so we can use that connection, I think that is a high priority.
Julie?
Thanks. My recollection was traffic near 50 vehicles a day would be a high estimate back before it closed, but it was posted then. I don't know if that's helpful, Carol. The county made tremendous efforts on the part of the to satisfy the farmers' wishes over the years and could never convince the state that they could justify putting any money into a bridge like this. Many, many things were tried. A number of years ago, there used to be specific funds for economic development roads and bridges, and we paid to put a road into where, I don't remember what it was called, the company that produced flax, the kind of neat clothing line.
Engelhart,
thank you. Yes, Engelhart. That was paid for. But those funds have not been around and available for a long, long time. So Martha's right. This serves a farmer. And the farmer continued to make money and thrive even when the bridge was closed. It's true that the other bridge, Mallaryville, was probably damaged by illegal use of it by some vehicles, but that's not what we're talking about tonight. I think that this is a bridge that didn't need to be reopened with public monies. We're just voting on the environmental impact statement tonight, so that's what I'm going to talk about. That's what I intended to talk about. If you look at packet pages, I think 22 and thereabouts, that explains the design deficiencies. This bridge is located in a intersecting a road where the sight distances are nowhere near adequate for safety. I read design for a 40 mile per hour speed limit on that road, and people drive significantly faster than that. So I don't think it's going to be a particularly safe improvement. But when you read the design deficiencies, there's nothing to be done about it so long as the bridge is put right in the same place, and that's what's happening. At the public meeting that I went to, there was one person from Groton who strongly requested that the historic members go to Groton because it's a Groton bridge. And instead, I understand that it's going to Dryden instead, and I'm not sure why that happened. The environmental impact assessment says that nothing is known about wetlands in the area. We know the maps are no good. They couldn't fill out that part of it's probably you, Jeff, couldn't fill out that part of the form correctly. But what I did was I called county planning and said there are new wetlands maps now. And Dryden was the first town that was done as a pilot for this new wetland mapping approach. So is there a map available that would show the wetlands in the area of the closed bridge? And yes, there is, and I got a copy of it today. And it's not so much that it tells me anything I didn't already know, because I've been out there many times, but it shows that we didn't really follow through as seriously as we might have with this environmental assessment form. And that disappoints me. So I'm going to be voting against this for a great history of reasons, but not the least of which is I don't think the form is completed correctly.
I guess since it's my district, I need to interject that, among other things, the town of Dryden will be paying over $300,000 toward this project as its 20% share. And as far as where the old bridge ends up, the historic bridge, it needs to be preserved, but it was the town of Dryden that built that bridge and paid for it. So, and it's in the town of Dryden, so I just would make that point. Are we ready to vote? Peter?
Let me ask you a question.
Use the microphone, Peter, please.
Yeah. I'm not an expert in this, but I do remember having heard this discussion for many years. And I just wonder, presumably the farm was not demolished by not having access. They found other ways to get their product to the grocery store or something like that. How do we decide? How do you take into account the traffic that goes over a bridge? When is there some point where you say, well, it's too slow, it's too low, and we won't refix that bridge, we'll just let it die? Or what? I mean, is there some kind of a cutoff, or is it anyway that makes one decide to do this bridge but not do that bridge? I realize that's not much.
In
I'm just wondering what you say.
Yeah, I love your questions, Peter. They're always so. I can't wait to answer all of your questions. So, do my best. But in areas that I've seen bridges closed. and never reopen, and decisions are made that, okay, this is an area that does not ever need access. There's no viability. There's no reason to ever. Those are areas. I've never seen any areas in Tompkins County like that. Very, very few ever. And those areas that I could describe are more like in the North Country where I'm originally from, where they're accessing an area of state forest where the state is the only owner and they're making the decision that the road will stop here and there will be a trailhead. Very, very few times I would ever advocate for not needing a bridge. I believe that, you know, you're going backwards. You're not progressing forward when you're looking at, you know, there's development, there's improved roads on both sides in this area. We have a single-lane historical bridge in Mowryville with a small hamlet. People are trying to see the heavy trucks and the school buses and the for fire protection and things like that, needing access. When you're making a decision, you're making a long-term decision. I talked about this when we talked about Groton City Road, where you know, you're not deciding for today or next year or 5 years. You're looking at a long ways in the future, and I certainly can't see that far ahead. But I can see both sides of this bridge are very developed. They're improved roads. There's viable land. And there was a bridge there once. And if you don't, you know, if you don't think about and try and maintain the bridge that's there, if that was done, we wouldn't be talking about this now. Unfortunately, it wasn't done. And I feel like that's somewhat of a failure on our department or the highway and not recognizing the need to keep that bridge up to standards as time goes on. That's what we're looking at doing now with all of our infrastructure in the county. The reality is this bridge is closed, and I can't advocate for not reopening it. I think it's very necessary.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Mike. I would request again a roll call vote on this.
Certainly. Anna Kellis?
You mentioned earlier that you suspected that this road, this bridge once rebuilt, would be a primary passage for buses, I think, and you mentioned one other. Is that, did I hear you wrong, that is one primary use?
School buses, the school bus driver in the area was at the public meeting, and they were very happy to hear that we were going to be doing this. By the posting on the Mowryville Bridge, they're not legal to go across that bridge.
So what is the alternative path that the buses or school buses are taking right now?
They have to drive around. They have to drive out of their way. I'm not sure exactly the route that they take, depending on where the students are. But they were one of the parties happy to hear. Fire departments are also very happy. Emergency services, that sort of thing. Generally see a great improvement in the area for this sort of stuff.
Which actually brings up the second part of my question. I mean, the reason why that I'm asking is because I do understand the question that I think is being proposed by Carol and Dooley, which is, we have finite funds and we have a ton of projects. Obviously, that's the point of a prioritization. Mm-hmm. Where does this fall? You know, we're looking, stepping back from the emotion of it. Where is it as far as a priority? So I understand that question, and that's why I'm asking if there are critical uses beyond, you know, the farmer, which I definitely understand the value to the farmer. So the other entities that came forward, you said the school system, emergency system, fire department. Are there any other entities that were in support of this that might be valuable to bring up to the group?
There were all the residents in the area that signed a petition that went to the town of Dryden. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but the town of Dryden passed a resolution in favor of reopening Red Mill in a two-lane structure as well. There were a group of residents that signed a petition that were attached to that resolution. So there was a lot of local input as well in favor of this project. Specific entities, I think you named them all already.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Martha, then let's please vote.
I'm not sure if this question is for Jeff or for Jonathan. So can you explain to me why we're making the seeker determination now rather than at the time in conjunction with the decision about whether to move forward with this project? And why it's a short form rather than a more complete environmental evaluation?
Yeah, I can kind of answer that.
Can I ask the first, what was the first part of your question, Carol?
Why are we doing this? Usually these come to us prior to the vote about moving forward with a project. So what's the process following this? Does this project come back to this body at all afterwards? And usually we see them in the packets together. With spending the money.
This project was a part of the capital program that was approved as a part of the operating and capital budget last fall. So that was really, that was the legislature saying that this is going to be a part of our capital program. We're going to go forward with this. So that was the green light on the project. So that's why, I think that's why the seeker is the next logical step in the progression. And let me, if I could say, I've got the microphone. I think I'm not sure it's clear that we had a choice to make. There are two bridges nearby. You have Mallaryville Road and you have Red Mill Road, and we were going to have to make a major investment in one of these two bridges because you got to move traffic across at one of those two spots, Mallaryville or Red Mill, and it would have to be a full blown reconstruction. So the question was, where do we invest our money? Where is that money best spent, Mallaryville or Red Mill? And that's when we went to the community. That's when we went to Dryden, had a talk with town officials there, including the town planner. And then we went to a neighborhood presentation and talked to the neighborhood about choices, too. And clearly, the preference in Dryden, both at the official level and the neighborhood level, was to put our eggs into the Red Mill basket, to invest in that. And then, as kind of a secondary point of crossing, to do some repair of Mallaryville, but certainly not a full-blown reconstruction. That's why we're here. That's why we're talking about Red Mill. So I'm not sure that that was coming through in the presentation, but that's why we're here with the Red Mill project.
How much have we spent on Mallaryville or are committed to spend, and would this mean that you won't be coming to us with further spending on Mallaryville?
The projects are one and, right, and the same. They're together. It's all coming out of the same fund.
So at this point, we're doing both.
Yep, that's the plan.
Yes, that's the problem, is that we're doing both rather than having picked one, which is what we initially, the legislature had initially decided to do.
Martha?
Well, Joe really wants us to say
that. Well, only that we did pick one. So we picked Red Mill, and that is the major reconstruction. That's the expensive one. But also, we are going to put a relatively small amount of money, and Jeff may have that number, and I don't.
$150,000 to $200,000.
To keep Mallaryville a passable bridge, at least for the midterm future, a passable bridge. So that's how we came to be here.
And I would add that the issue with Mallaryville was if we had made it the bridge, if we'd let go of Red Mill, we would have had to make it a larger bridge. And wouldn't that have put like that bridge in the front porch of at least one of those houses right there, and maybe houses would have had to come down? I mean, there's no space there to make a bigger bridge. And honestly, if the folks of Mallaryville knew that we have three minute time, public speaking, and that they could come and tell us how important that bridge was to their community, maybe we would pay attention to their needs as well as we pay attention to the people who know to come here. We give lip service to supporting businesses in this community. We give lip service to supporting agriculture, and to supporting communities. And by the way, in terms of prioritizing our projects, if we don't trust our staff to figure out what are the right projects to bring to us in the right order, then heaven help us, because we don't know. None of us here is an expert on highway maintenance, excuse me. And that's why we have a staff person. We have staff and highway managers. And I we have been through this. We have talked about this project over the years, and it takes a very long time to drive around Ed Heil Road and it's like way into the woods. And it's like, this is a very rural area. And if these bridges go away, it's like miles around. And in terms of an emergency vehicle, that's life and death. In terms of school buses, that's a lot of fuel wasted. I mean, this is something that we just need to do.
All right, let's vote. We've been asked to have a roll call vote. The clerk will call the roll, please.
Mr. John?
Yes.
Ms. Kellis?
Yes.
Ms. Kiefer?
No.
Mr. Klein?
Yes.
Mrs. McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Mr. Morey?
Yes.
Ms. Robertson?
Yes.
Mr. Sigler?
Yes.
Mr. Stein?
Yes.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
No.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Mr. Lane?
Yes. Does anyone wish to change her or his vote? Please announce the vote.
12 ayes, 2 noes.
Resolution passes. It's 7:30, time for a break. When we come back, I'm going to turn to Leslie McBean-Claiborne for her report on HHS, and I know Frank Krupa is here to talk to us a little bit, too, from that report. Leslie, Frank Krupa was kind enough to mention that he's going to stay here longer even after you report, but let's still go ahead and do that, get that behind us.
Sure.
Give us your report from the Health and Human Services Committee, please.
That's so kind of Frank. Health and Human Services, we met on March 3rd, right after our last legislature meeting. We talked about the committee goals. We had some conversation around narcotics and opiates and heroin use in our community. One of the things that we're hoping that we can get, because we keep hearing about epidemic, but we're looking for actual data. And so we're hoping the committee talked about looking for data on the heroin problem as well as other narcotics in our community, and we hope to get that information soon. One of the things we also talked about as a committee, although I can't remember if we talked about it as a committee, I've had so many conversations, is getting a presentation from the mayor and members of the group that worked on the municipal drug policy for the city of Ithaca. It would be useful to have the mayor come to the Health and Human Services Committee, and we hope that we'll have an opportunity to ask questions. But we thought that as the outstart, at least I did, since this might have some serious implications for our county as a whole, that all of our legislators should be privy to that presentation at the same time. So we're all operating from the same knowledge base that we receive, rather than having it filtered through me or the committee. So we're reaching out to the mayor to see if he can, when he can, come and present to this body at one of our meetings so that we can hear that. And then at a future meeting at committee level, if we have more in-depth questions that we'd like to ask of him and the members of the committee. We talked a little bit, and one of the resolutions that we have that's on consent agenda had to do with acceptance of funds
I know we changed the name of it, that had to do with sexually exploited youth. Yes, we changed the name because we did not want to accept sexually exploited youth funds from the Office of Children and Family Services. We wanted to accept those funds to deal with issues surrounding sexually exploited youth in our community. Amy Hendricks from the Youth Tompkins County Youth Bureau shared a little bit with us around that, and we, again, the committee is looking for more information. We wanted, what kind of data do we have in our community that speaks to this issue? There was a presentation, I know, at the Human Services Coalition Forum, I think it was last Wednesday, I believe. I don't know if anybody was able to attend, about this very topic. And we hope, Amy did promise to get as much information as she can get to bring back to us. Do we have some concerns about this issue in our community? Yes, we do, on all levels. But we hope to get some more substantial information so we know where we stand and what all the action steps we need to be taken to rid our community of anything like this. The bulk of our meeting was spent with our health department and Frank talking to us and giving us some updates, but particularly talking to us about the issue of lead in our community. As you all know, there's been a lot of news on what's going on in the schools relative to lead testing and lead in the water and the drinking water, etc. So we wanted to hear from Frank sort of the soup to nuts presentation on the health department's role in testing for lead, connection with the schools when something like this happens, regulations, and Frank and I'm going to blank on her name now.
Liz Cameron.
Liz gave us a very thorough presentation with a lot of questions from the community around this issue, our role, and advice in what action steps are expected to be taken in the near future, probably all along as we go along, regarding this issue. Some of it includes how do we not calm the nurse, but calm the nurse and reassure our caregivers, our parents, our residents, that our water supply is safe and will be safe and what it is that we are doing. So not only the regulatory things that we're looking at, but we're also looking at that human factor that really matters. How do we talk to our community? How do we communicate that they understand, in layman's terms, what has been going on and what is being done to deal with the issue? So that was the bulk of our meeting, that presentation. If you have more specific questions, Frank is here. He can speak more to that. Our committee members can also weigh in as well. And that's my report.
Thank you, Leslin. Questions? I'm going to ask Frank to come up for a few minutes. But before that, are there any questions for Leslin on other issues she brought up? Frank, could you join us, please?
I'm something else.
Go ahead, Carol.
Did we have some? Did I talk about this somewhere else, or did we have some discussion at committee as to whether there would be enough time at a legislature meeting for the discussion with the mayor, and whether we might want to ask if people wanted to do that maybe an hour before a legislature meeting?
You're talking about the drug policy?
The drug policy.
Yeah, you must have been sleeping, baby, because I talked about that. That was the first thing I talked about.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I know I heard you talk about
that we were going to try and invite
legislature,
the mayor.
But, you know, but the question was when, if it was enough time at a legislature meeting, or whether we should pick a time that was contiguous with, but not necessarily only at the meeting.
I think we all were sort of in agreement that we wanted this at a legislature meeting, at some kind of full legislative body meeting so that everyone can hear that, and I'll consult with the chair, and we'll see how that happens.
Great. Thank you.
Frank Krupa is our Commissioner of Health. Frank, do you want to start on the issue of lead? I don't know if we want to go the full soup to nuts tonight, but we might, if you could give us the abbreviated version maybe tonight.
Sure. I'll try to be brief, and then if there are areas of interest, I can answer questions. So by now everyone's aware that the health department regulates drinking water systems of all shapes and sizes, both small and large. What we're dealing with the Ithaca City School District is that two individual schools, Caroline and Enfield, they are not on a municipal or large-scale drinking water system, so they're on a well, and they have their own system. So it makes the school district essentially a de facto water system operator for both of those systems. There were samples that were taken in August that had high results. There were some delays in review, both within the department and without the water system. I want to be clear, the water system operator is responsible for taking samples. The health department does not take those samples. The water system operator does. They are also responsible for notification to the public. We are the regulatory authority, which is charged with ensuring that they do those things. So that is our role in the process. And once we discovered the high results in December, we immediately contacted the district and required that resampling be taken, and that once that resampling was done, we required the public notification that went out. The sample results that came back in January, while not perfect, at both schools, were within the drinking water requirements, and therefore the district had the requirement to notify their public that they had done that. But other than working to address the very specific issues at the sites that did test high, they would have been in compliance with our drinking water rule. The district decided that they wanted to sample all of the drinking water sites within those two schools and hired a contractor to do that sampling. There was a problem with the sampling procedure that was followed from the health department's perspective that we believe is what caused the results that came back that we've all seen in the paper that were very, very high in multiple locations throughout the schools. So after getting that information, the school took the steps of shutting off the drinking water sources in those two schools and providing drinking water to the students. So we've eliminated the exposure there at the schools to give us time to work with the district and determine what is really the status of the system and what steps can be taken to ensure that the drinking water being supplied to the students and the faculty and staff is safe for consumption. So that work continues. We are in the process of collecting new samples at both of those schools. So 2 weeks ago, we took samples ourselves. Our staff went out. We took the samples. We sent those off to Wadsworth, which is the state laboratory, which is the reference lab for all labs in the state. And we're still awaiting those results to come back. The succeeding week, the district, under our observation, also took those same samples from both of those schools because we want to be able to ensure that we can duplicate the results and that the district has the capability moving forward to implement sampling procedures successfully. We have, so we are awaiting those results. Once those results come in, we will evaluate them and we will work with the district to put a plan together to ensure that the water is safe for folks. Subsequent to all of this happening, the district made the decision to take samples in all of their other schools that are on large-scale drinking water systems. And the difference here, and the reason those schools aren't sampled, is because they are on either the City of Ithaca's water system or Bolton Point, which are significantly larger distribution systems. So if you imagine at Enfield and Caroline, they are a self-contained distribution system, so every site on those systems is within a school, so of course samples would be taken from a school. On a larger scale system, that is not the case. The system, in working with the health department, develops a sampling plan which then samples are taken throughout their distribution systems. And more often than not, schools are not chosen as sampling sites for those larger distribution systems. So the schools on those larger systems, there is no requirement for them to be sampled. There is EPA guidance that's provided to school districts on how to go forward if they choose to do sampling, and it is certainly recommended. The district went forward and took some samples. We also believe that there were some sampling problems through that process as well. So we're not 100% confident in the results that came out of them. But because those results were high, the district took the step of turning the drinking water off in all of their schools and providing drinking water to eliminate the exposure to students, faculty, and staff until they could figure out an answer for the problem. So that work is underway. The district has released an RFP to get an expert to help them navigate this process and work with us. The Environmental Protection Agency has been in contact with the district and us at the local health department, and we have been working with the New York State Department of Health from the outset. So the EPA's role is to help provide guidance to the districts around how they move forward. They are very complimentary of the work that we have done so far, and they are happy to hear that the health department is involved in the process moving forward. So we have, we continue to work with the Ithaca City School District and look forward to their RFP being complete and them selecting someone to help continue the process. What we have done for the rest of the community from a drinking water perspective, we have provided the EPA guidance for schools to all districts. We did that a few weeks ago. Subsequently, we have also kind of boiled down that large document into a two-page kind of guidance on the guidance to help them understand what appropriate sampling procedures would be, and we've provided that to all of them and is available on our website. So we're moving forward with that. They do not have a requirement to contact the health department before they move forward, but we are certainly recommending that they do include us in that process, and so far communication has been pretty good as we've gone forward there. So that's the drinking water piece. I do want to touch on the health piece so I don't forget that. There's been a lot of information about what the health department does when an elevated blood lead level is found in the community, and I want to be clear, the New York State requirement for elevated blood lead levels and action in a community is 15 micrograms per deciliter. In Tompkins County, we have multiple thresholds below that that drive action from us. So at 10, as we reduce the number at 10 micrograms per deciliter, we will send out a sanitarian and a community health nurse to work with the family to identify any sources that can be remediated so that the child's blood won't continue to rise and ultimately can begin to decline. At 8 micrograms per deciliter, we make a phone call to the family to let them know that their child has elevated blood leads above the 5 micrograms per deciliter. So they're getting a proactive call from us to communicate what resources are available. And then at the 5 micrograms per deciliter, they get a letter from the health department, which includes information about elevated blood lead levels and includes potential sources and steps that can be taken. So reports that the health department does not respond, that our response point is higher than the CDC recommendation is not correct. We do respond at anything that is 5 or above, although the state requirement is that we respond at 15 or above. So we are both exceeding the New York State Department of Health requirement, and we are meeting the CDC requirement for response to elevated blood lead levels.
All right, let's see if we have questions for Frank. Thanks that you gave us a lot of information in a very short space there, Frank.
Thank you, Frank.
Martha Robertson.
Thank you, Frank. Just to be kind of in plain English for people listening, when you described it at the committee, it's the issues of protocols. It's like, did the testers let the water flush the appropriate amount of time, or did they take sort of the first water out of the tap after sitting overnight and that sort of thing. And so it may sound technical when you talk about protocols, but you can also imagine it really matters in terms of what's actually safe when people are using the water. But I think, and this is more a comment, I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. There was a report, I guess, yesterday about Newark, the Newark City schools, and Newark and five additional counties in New Jersey that have dangerous lead levels, and it seems may have had for a long time. And I think the issue is certainly the city of Newark must, those schools must be on municipal water, but the issue of fixtures, of pipes inside buildings and fixtures that include lead solder is something it seems like the country might just suddenly be waking up to. And, you know, that sounds like a very massive infrastructure project to fix those fixtures. I mean, do you have an estimate of what would really be required?
So it's important to understand that we are fortunate that we're talking about pipes and drinking water and these very low levels of lead that we're being exposed to in our environment. Years ago, we were dealing with lead-based paint and leaded gasoline, and those still are the most common sources that we see driving elevated blood lead levels. So as we get better as a community at reducing our exposure in those high exposure areas, we do then have to start to begin to look at the lower exposure routes, but that are still exposures. And so I think that's kind of where we're getting to. It's important to point out the media has talked about that 5 microgram per deciliter blood lead level for the CDC. The reason that number moved is because it's a reference point, and it's based on 2.5% of the population and what is the level that 2.5% or less of the children tested would be below that. And so the reason that that number moves is because we've gotten better at removing the exposure points within our communities to get less and less children having higher and higher blood leads. So that reference number is going to continue to move until we get it to zero. That's our ultimate goal. The issue, if you look at the CDC's guidance, they have not changed the point where they expect medical intervention for a child. That's still 45 micrograms per deciliter. So where the risk hasn't moved, but
45,
correct. So if you look at their guidance where they expect that you're going to take a medical intervention and begin chelation, it's at 45 micrograms per deciliter for children, correct, 6 or under.
Unfortunately, I happen to know the Cornell researcher who discovered that there's no safe level for children.
No, and I would agree, but
right. I mean, our regulations are clearly behind the research, and that there's intellectual damage.
Correct, and I would agree that the goal is zero, and certainly we're trying to get there. But I'm just trying to explain the reason that 5 microgram per deciliter number now exists where it is because it's a reference point, not because it's a change in risk or risk level. We are trying to get to zero. That is our goal, and that's where we're getting to. And again, I would reiterate that Tompkins County responds at 5 or higher to begin providing service to families.
Dan Klein.
Frank, as the situation's unfolded, I've heard a couple times the good news is that no kid has tested positive for lead. I've even repeated that line a few times. I wonder if you could say a little more about that.
Sure. So there's a couple of things. The very specific is we know that over 100 children from the Ithaca City school system have been tested at the two local pediatrician offices, and we have not seen an elevated blood lead level confirmed above 5. That's the first piece. On the macro scale, Tompkins County does not have a record of anyone ever having an elevated blood lead level with drinking water as the primary source. New York State tells us that's the case for New York State, but I don't have that data, so I can't confirm that. But we do have it for Tompkins County. So we know that the water and the water systems haven't changed that folks are being exposed to currently, and we have not seen elevated blood lead levels because of those systems to date. And that's really where that statement comes from us.
If these children that have been tested locally, how does the health department get that information? Is that mandatory that the doctors give you that info?
Yeah, so there's a statewide database that those results go into. We monitor that database daily, and we respond based off of the results to it. I will tell you that the main providers for children are pediatrics, and a couple of our family providers are very proactive about notifying the health department if they get an elevated test. And I would point out that there are levels to testing. So there's a screening where you ask questions about exposure, potential exposure routes that the provider asked. The finger stick is the next step. We require that at 1 and 2 years of age, but it can be done at any point. And then if we see an elevated level with a finger stick, we then send folks for a blood test where a blood draw is actually done, and that can give us a very specific result and confirm if there's an elevated blood lead level. So there are steps to that screening process.
While I have the mic, just a quick second to congratulate you. You were reappointed to the Danby as the Danby Planning Board Chair last night. I don't know if you knew that.
I did not. Thank you,
Dan. Some
of you
may not know that that's another French role. So.
Peter Stein.
Okay, that's interesting. It's put it all into perspective. But I feel impelled to say this, that you cannot say that zero is the goal. You can't make it zero. There's lead all over the place. Every place there's radioactivity, there's lead. And there's no way of absolutely getting rid of all of the lead. But it's not that poisonous. I mean, it's not as poisonous as cyanide. There are a lot of things that that if you have a whole lot less than that, you'll die. An arsenic, you know, there's all kinds of things that are in the ground. So there must be some point where you say, well, below that, you don't have to worry about that. If you really say that you have to worry about it all the time, no matter how low it is, then you go crazy from it. And I'm trying to understand when I read these things, are we at that level where the water is at some number, and at that number we say is we don't really have to worry about this anymore?
So the short answer is we had samples that came in above the accepted levels for drinking water.
Uh-huh.
And so we're investigating why that happened so we can put remediations in place so we can get them below those levels. You're absolutely right. Getting to zero is the ideal. Whether or not that's ultimately achievable is a much bigger discussion. But there is proof that we have identified in the past, within the last 40 years, that there were unacceptable exposures to lead in lead-based paint and leaded gasoline, and that has allowed us to drive down the reference point, again, for children that have elevated blood lead levels of all that are tested. So it is a goal, and we always want to be working towards limiting exposure to things we know have human health effects, negative human health effects. So the goal will always be zero. How close to zero we can get depends on time and effort and whether we're willing to accept the risk that comes with not hitting zero.
Anna.
So I guess I first just want to say, Peter, I take tremendous offense to saying that lead is not that poisonous. I went to a town hall meeting recently and met a man who is permanently on disability and crippled by lead poisoning from his career path. So I just want to point that out, that it is exceptionally poisonous at high levels. And I think that there are many people in the community that would take tremendous offense to that. I wanted to ask a few questions. I guess, or just make a few comments. I know that the EPA recommendation is zero, although the actionable level is 15. And I think, according to the CDC, that there is no defined level for children that is considered safe as of yet. So again, I understand that that's probably why our goal is zero, which I applaud, and I think it absolutely should be, because the evidence is showing that zero really is what the goal absolutely should be, especially at this age. My biggest concern and sort of the tipping point for me was, again, when I went to this town hall meeting, I met a woman whose daughter goes to Caroline, and she was tested and came up with a blood lead level of 4.7, which to me is too close to 5. And so we have this, you know, cutoff that's the 98th percentile below, or two distribution levels below the average, which is how we estimate it, which is not necessarily based on health. It's based on a distribution, two standard deviations below the average. That's how you create it. It's statistics. It's irrelevant to health. And so, you know, I hear that level, and if I were her, I were her mother, I would be, you know, phenomenally disturbed. So I guess... I see the steps that you're taking, and I applaud them, and they're, you know, they are exceeding the EPA levels. I guess my comment to the group here is that I think that we should question the EPA standards. I think we should question 15 microliters or micrograms or parts per billion, I'm sorry, as the actionable point, and I hope we can move forward in considering putting something or some statement together to the EPA saying, you know, we really think that that should be reevaluated. So I guess my only question is, for this mother, what can we do considering how tremendously close that is to 5, if there's any steps that we could take? Because 4.7, 5.0, given that it's an arbitrary number based on standard deviations of statistics, it's not related to health. Do you have any thoughts of what we might do for her moving forward and daughter, children like her?
Sure. So I can't talk specifically about any individual's health issues because of privacy reasons, but from a general perspective, the recommendations that we've made from the beginning is that parents talk with their primary care providers, whether it be a pediatrician or family practice, and get testing as they see appropriate. What you would most often see a physician recommend if they saw a level that was 5 or below is, let's check it again in 6 months, or let's check it again in 12 months. If it continues to rise, then we move into the level of, do we need to go get a blood draw done to see what the blood lead level actually is in a more specific state so we can move forward with that. And that's not me saying that. That is the provider, the doctor that the family has chosen, and that is the expert for that child on what their care should be. I think we continue to provide information on this issue and would certainly support any provider or family who contacted our department with a child that had any lead detection to give them as much information as we could. The issue becomes what is acceptable from a health standpoint and what isn't. And I would never profess to tell a parent what is an acceptable exposure to anything for their child. That's for them and their chosen healthcare provider to decide. But we have to set standards based on community interest and the science that we have in front of us. And while, yes, there is science that is telling us that at lower levels we can see children be affected by it, We're still looking at trying to get them to a point that we can reasonably achieve, that we feel is reasonably safe for them. And those are community and public health standards, not individual standards.
So just as a quick follow-up, given how close her level was, there's the possibility that, and she, as a student at Caroline, it increases the chance, in my mind, statistically speaking, that there are some children who are at 5. Is it possible that we could make, I know previously we're saying, you know, we aren't necessarily recommending that the parents get their children tested. Is that something that we could consider as the county department to put out a public statement that we are encouraging, given some of the levels are close? Is that a step we could move forward doing?
Is it a step we could do? Yes. Is it a step I would recommend? No. I believe the appropriate guidance still, based on all the information we have, is that parents should talk with their primary care providers about what the appropriate care for their children is. Because a child that has 4.7, that has no underlying health issues, and there may have been, I don't know, some recent remodeling or paint in the house that is no longer there, there may be no issue that I would recommend they take further step on. That doesn't mean that the parents can't. And we certainly are open to answering questions and providing information. We have programs within our department. Our Healthy Neighborhoods program deals with health and safety in homes. We could send people out with you know elevated blood lead levels and provide information about health and safety in the home that talks about lead. So there are resources that we can provide to folks, but the best course of action is for parents to talk to their health care providers. And I'm not prepared to recommend that everyone do that based on the exposure to the water at the schools, because the science that we have and what we know about drinking water, it most likely, if there is an elevated blood lead level, is not the cause, that there is another cause that has yet to be identified.
One really quick follow-up question. We did EPA sample testing to EPA standards recently. Do we have any dates when those will be back and those results will be back?
No, they're at the laboratory now, and we're waiting for those results to come in. I do want to be clear, though, that we are not going to just blindly release data. It is our intent to get that data, review it, make sure we understand what the data means, consult with the New York State Department of Health and most likely the EPA, and then present those results with our evaluation of what they tell us.
Okay, I want to tell you where we are. We're at 8:15. We do have more business tonight. We have more. We have an executive session on the list. I have who haven't spoken. I have Rich and Carol and Mike, and then Martha would like to speak again, and then I'd really like to move on. Rich?
Frank, you used a term, I think, in regard to treatment, chelation. Could you just tell us? I don't know what that is.
Yeah, it's a very complicated and difficult process to try to remove lead from the blood. And so if you have a child and or an adult that has an elevated blood lead level, there are medical processes to try to remove it from the blood. But it is very difficult, time-consuming, costly, and not all that effective. So the goal, the idea is to reduce exposure so we don't get to that point. And that is typically for folks that have been exposed, again, through lead-based paint, leaded gasoline, or through an occupational exposure.
Thank you.
We have Carol.
Yes, Frank, thank you. I had appreciated hearing your explanation at the committee. And I thought, Annie, that you did an incredibly good job at that town hall meeting, which was like an hour later after we left, explaining to the crowd the testing procedures and why it's important to make sure that they're correct, just in lay terms. And so I have much greater confidence than before we heard from you that we're, that we're doing what we need to do and working with the EPA. I'm glad the EPA is here. But I think that there are really two very different issues about people's perception of their water quality, whether it's lead or other chemicals, and the age of our aging infrastructure, as Martha pointed out, so that the ways that we can think about how to restore that public confidence may be very different than what we do in a crisis situation like this, where we're trying to figure out, where are the levels, what do we need to do for children in the schools, and I don't think the aging infrastructure is getting any younger. The problems, I don't think, in people's minds are limited only to the schools. In our own homes, if the primary source of lead, for example, and it's not the only chemical or substance in our waters, is from solder, as those solder joints get older and older, whether my faucet, in my bathroom or kitchen sink is good, is something that's going to start to be of concern to people. And as this is in the news around the country, I don't think we're seeing the levels here that we're hearing in the other parts of the country. So I would be interested for our upcoming budget process in hearing not how we can go, because we can't go and replace all the aging infrastructure in the entire community and in everybody's homes overnight any more than we can on any other kind of infrastructure, but what are the kinds of things that we can do to make sure that the public has information so that we can all decide
what do I need to do to evaluate the my own water coming out of my faucet? And I know we do a lot of that when people call and ask, but information just about how do you get your own water tested in your home? What's the cost? What's the process? How do you know if you send away to a kit on Amazon that it's not the same as getting a professional lab and holding public information session about something like that or releasing information is something that would cost us some staff time, but is not the same kind of cost. Are there filters you can buy to alleviate any of the possible issues? How do you read your annual water quality report? We get those reports every year if you're on any of the major water supplies as opposed to your own well about what's in your water, and it's a long list of things, and I don't know how to interpret it. What else? How do you figure out what your own water supply is and what your own pipes are made of? How would I know whether I had lead pipes in my home? So it's things like that that maybe it would cost us something in staff time and might be worth it to just get to see if it's worth it to give us a budget request to hold that kind of information session. And another one that just off the top of my head had occurred to me was, is it possible to arrange a bulk purchasing program for our residents privately to get their water tested, but if you do it in this time period, you'll get one of the solar panels that we got a 30% discount if you did it as one bulk purchase. I don't know if that's an option. But there's other things short of changing all our infrastructure that we might look at and might be worth in the future. Thank you.
Okay, great. Mike Sigler.
My question's quick, and you probably can't answer it. It's pretty clear to me that those two schools are going to have to rip out their pipes and put new pipes in. Is the school even talking about that, or are we still just talking about testing?
So to be quite honest with you, I don't think it is clear that ripping out the pipes and replacing them is necessarily the answer. And this is part of the reason that we need to do sampling and do it effectively. There was a school district, I believe it was in Washington State, that did just that. And when they did their subsequent sampling, still had elevated lead levels. So it is important to go methodically through the process, determine what the source is, and then put a plan of action in place. And I can tell you that the district is they're bringing in an expert to help them not only with the sampling process, but to help design and understand what solutions they might take to move forward. I can't speak for what they would or wouldn't do, but I would caution against jumping to the conclusion that the only way to fix the problem is to rip things down or rip things out, because in some cases that may cause problems in other areas because you do those kind of things retroactively. So we may get there, but we're not there yet, and it is important for us to follow the science.
Thank you, Frank.
Martha, real short, please.
Yeah, very quickly. You said any parent where there's a level that you're worried about, you wait a period of time and see if it persists. You said it's hard to get lead out of the blood. Does it, if the exposure ends, does it kind of after a while just kind of get diluted and pass through the system? What happens?
You grow, and so your volume grows, and your blood lead levels can decrease because you grow. Getting lead out once it's in is extremely difficult. So you're not necessarily removing the lead so much as, let's call it, diluting by growing and expanding your volume. So that's really why you see the levels go down, not necessarily because the lead has gone away.
So that's why it's so, the younger the children are, the more the worry. Okay, and I would just point out that before anybody invests in redoing their plumbing, Frank pointed out at the committee, if you let the water run for a little while before you take a drink or fill the pasta pot, you really can avoid most of the issue. Thank you very much.
So as an adult, I'd literally have to get fatter to get...
Frank, thank you for taking your time tonight to talk to us about this. Let's see if we can go back to the agenda and see if we can get through it in reasonable time tonight.
Thank you, Frank.
For my report, I want to mention two things. One is that We have now, thanks to Katrina McCloy, who's been working on this for at our legislative staff, set up the meeting with the court, the lunch meeting with the Cortland legislators. We picked the day that was of the two we had a choice of that was had the most people who could attend. And that's going to be April 27th, which is a Wednesday. It'll be at 12:30 at the Perkins Restaurant in Cortland. Hopefully we can carpool to go up there. The next one, if we meet in the fall like we have in the past, we'll do that in Ithaca, so it'll be closer. And the reason we're not meeting in Dryden, where we used to meet, is because that restaurant has closed. So maybe one day that will reopen and we'll be able to try that one again. But if you'd like to come, we'd like to have you. And it's we go Dutch, we pay for our own meals, and have a good time learning from each other. Also mentioned that tomorrow night here in this chambers will be the Bicentennial Committee meeting. And we are moving ahead with some things, thinking about next year. We've selected the logo. We're going to be talking about things like permanent markers for historic sites. We're going to talk about how we can do celebrations and how much money we have to spend and where. We have some that this legislature has put aside for us, and we appreciate that. Anybody's welcome to come to the meeting. It's at 7:15 here. Generally runs about an hour and a half. I have no chair's appointments tonight. Let's go to staff reports. Joe Mariana is our county administrator.
Thanks, Mike. I'll go very quickly tonight. Several of us met with Barbara Lifton, Assemblywoman Lifton, last week to talk about our budget and legislative priorities. Mike, Martha, Glenn, Dan, Mike Sigler, and myself met with Barbara, did our best job to convey what's important to us to her. I haven't had the chance yet to look at the One House bills from the Assembly and the Senate. I'm not sure how successful we were in convincing our legislative delegation that things that are important to us are important to them as well. We've already seen community college aid isn't nearly what we had asked for it to be from either house. I think the governor was at zero. The Senate was at $150 per student. The Assembly was even less at $150. So I'll be going through those.
100.
Reporting. 100, I'm sorry. I'll be reporting to you on what we see in those One House bills soon. I talked to you last time about this new Cup of Joe thing that we're doing where I'm meeting with employees every Wednesday morning. I'm now through with two of 55 of those. This came out of the climate survey, and I'm finding it to be a great experience and a really good recommendation from this group. Small group dynamics, maybe 10 to 12 people in the room. I think they enjoy meeting each other a lot more than they enjoy meeting me and hearing from my level. It was predicted by some on the steering committee that might be the big benefit, where employees who work in extraordinarily diverse situations enjoy hearing what each other do. So it's so far so good. I keep looking at the clock because the next one is at 8:30 tomorrow morning, so I want to be fresh for the meeting. Last item on my list is the grant. We heard earlier tonight from a citizen who wanted to talk about that. Mid-afternoon, this afternoon, we did hit send on the grant application, so it is with the Department of State with a couple of hours to spare.
This is the police consolidation.
This is the police consolidation or shared services grant. So we were able to get it in on time. The maximum grant amount, if they accept our calculations for things, the maximum grant would be $1 million. Now, the difficulty with this grant, and we heard about it during the clinic that the Department of State offered a couple of weeks ago, is that the first installment is relatively small. So the maximum first installment is 5% of the whole grant, so it's $50,000. So our goal is to do what we can with that $50,000, to do a study without preordained conclusions, to do a study with that $50,000 and to report what comes out of that study in terms of what seem to be viable options, what are the pros, cons, and concerns that may be associated with each of those, bring those results back to the legislative bodies of each of the participants for guidance in terms of how to proceed next. It will be an open process. There shouldn't be concern about citizen involvement. There will be opportunities along the way during a study period before any recommendations are put forward for the community to be heard on the issue. So the good news is, with 2 hours to spare, we got the grant in. We think they like it based on what we heard at the clinic. We're hopeful that we'll get at least that first installment paid to us. I don't know the timing. I believe they're going to turn it around pretty quickly, so let's hope within the next 4 to 6 weeks we get a result back from them. That's my report.
Questions for Joe. Martha, then Dooley.
So first installment, you mean they only approve 50,000 at a time?
No. The way they've structured this, and I won't give you too much of the background, the first installment is essentially a kind of a proof of concept. So recall that this grant was intended to implement things that came forward in the government efficiency plan. So it really wasn't intended to do only studies. It was intended to implement some of the things that came forward. So the first 50 was really to get some things started in the implementation. I think we've convinced the state that first 50 is needed for us to study our options, but it's limited to $50,000. The goal is, again, to identify some viable options in that study, to bring it back to the legislatures, and at that point, if once direction is given by the legislative bodies, then we want more study money to really look in detail at some of the implementation aspects of the path that's been chosen. So there's an opportunity to get additional study money after we finish this first early study of kind of a framework.
Right, but I understand that the bulk of the grant really is consultant fees because it's complicated, and I think I remember $150,000. Well, that wouldn't be the bulk of a million, but $150,000 was expected you might need. I mean, are you saying that after spending $50,000, we should be prepared to decide how to go? Because that seems really constrained.
Right. I think at least a sense of direction should come out of that first study, where we're not looking at a wide range of options. We're looking at a small range of options that really need focus after that initial study.
I know, but that's what the community is worried about. I'm a little nervous that that's a really small start. Okay.
And let me just explain, because the $1 million, again, I've said we have a maximum grant of $1 million. We had first said we need about $150,000 or $200,000 to study. So we think we may still need that amount. So the first kind of preliminary study and then the follow-up study could amount to that, leaving a large balance. So whatever we decide we want to do, there's money available for the implementation of that with the balance of the grant.
Julie?
Joe, as I recall, we had a choice of whether to begin at the beginning with this process, or because, as was pointed out during the workshop or whatever it was, the county has already done things that could count as proof of concept. We could come in at step three instead of step one. It sounds like that's not what you've decided to do.
No, and the state really guided us to this point as opposed to that fast track point.
And
so this is really the recommendation.
Better.
I think it gives us more of an opportunity to do the study. So the fast track would really take us to an implementation finish line more quickly. Where here we have the opportunity to do, again, that first study. And $50,000 is not a small amount of money for a study. So I think we can get a lot of insights out of that. And in the study, I would envision there being community input during the course of that study. So I don't think we present something to the community after that study is done. I think it's very much a part of it. So again, state guided us in this direction. They felt comfortable with the structure. And I do think what I'm hearing is we do need time to study before we actually pick a course and begin to implement, which would have been the fast track course.
So were the things that were suggested at that meeting, such as uniformity of training modules, is that the kind of thing that you're now contemplating studying in this first look?
I think we'll have to figure out a range of things that we would want the consultant to look at, and it would be the range that we described originally. So it could begin, the range could include things like functional consolidations. So you don't look at the consolidation of departments, you look at a function, and the one that we talked about at the clinic, and it's hypothetical, would be investigations, for example. Could you have a single investigation unit that served all departments? So that's a functional consolidation. So the range of options could begin there. It could go to a number of variations in between that and a full consolidation. There are some places that are approaching it in small bites, whereas an officer of one department leaves, that officer is replaced by someone from another department, county department, for example. So in Jamestown, for example, that's a model being followed. So there's a whole variety of things, all the way from, again, the small functional consolidations all the way to a full-blown merger. So that would be the range of options that we can look at. I think we need going in to kind of narrow the field a bit for the consultant to study. And that will be a part of the RFP process, and I've committed that we will come back and talk to the legislature about the RFP before it's issued.
We have Anna, then Peter.
So I guess curious if the steps that we've already taken and the information that we've already gathered that led us to think that we might be eligible or might be advisable to go in the fast track, will that information be valuable to, in that study phase, help us sort of streamline that and make it more effective? I guess that's my first question.
Well, I think it's going to be important as we apply for the next rounds of funding under this grant. I mean, one of the things the state wants to know is it feasible to think that change can happen in your community? And so that's their proof of concept. That's the kind of things that they're looking for. So, boy, I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but the way the state is looking for most communities to approach this, they want a small sample example of the larger thing that you're trying to do. So if we were talking about back office services, for example, forget about law enforcement, they might want you to try web page maintenance or something like that to show that the partners can get along and they can pull something like this together. Here we can show that we already have a bunch of things that we have done in law enforcement especially that shows that we are able to do things in creative ways. We can consolidate things. We've done the 911 center. We've done LETS. We've done a bunch of technology. That's going to help us score points as they look at funding at future elements of the grant. So that will help us there.
So there, you know, if we get the 50,000, there will be a bunch of communities potentially competing, doing the study, and then competing with the value and strength of their proof of concept. So then the idea is, because we have some evidence of collaboration that we can include in that study report, that may help the strength of our...
I wish I'd put it that well. That's exactly right. So once you go through the first round, you're really not competing with others, but you do have to demonstrate to the state that you have a worthy proposal to get more money. So you said it perfectly.
And then my other question, in the proof of concept, are they incorporating in the consideration of the cultural climate of the community in that proof of concept?
They will be trying to determine whether there is a will and a capacity within the community to implement whatever is recommended from this study. So in that respect, yes.
So we'll be surveying the community as well as evaluation within the departments.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's a survey of the community. Certainly they want some indication that the community would be supportive of this, that after they invest money in this initiative, that it won't end up in failure, that there's a reasonable chance of success, which, of course, depends on community support.
Right. Because I feel like that would be a really valuable component since, you know, technically it's their money. But I look forward to seeing that part.
Pete, wrap us up.
Yeah, I was at that meeting and listened, and my own thoughts were I was a little bit disappointed when the number 50,000 came out, but nonetheless, it's the only game in town if you want to do this. And I think if we have to play nickel and dime by saying, keeping track, we're going to spend a little bit more than $50,000, so let's not do that. Let's make sure that we're going to get everything back. I think that'd be a mistake. I think we have to do the best we can with the rules that they've given and, you know, try to make a good proposal and don't be too hung up by the amount of money that they're going to give us back. That's my own way of thinking about it.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks.
County attorney is Jonathan Wood.
No report.
Okay. Any questions for Jonathan? Finance director, Rex Snyder.
I had one notification I received today that I would like to pass on to the legislature, and it was interesting from the New York State Gaming Commission that, as you know, there is a $50 million of casino license fees that's being distributed to a number of counties, both host counties and those that are close to the host county. This is for the Lago Resort and Casino. So after reading through the email and having received a few of these before, we did get the actual ACH payment, which is posted for tomorrow, and I wanted to give you the amount, Tompkins County portion of just the license fees for the Lago Resort and Casino is $1,195,165.87. So this close to $1.2 million, which is basically a license fee that we get to share in, is just part of what Tompkins County is supposed to receive. I think you might remember a number of emails I sent out to each of the legislators back in October. It was a press release that talked about the budget details for the upcoming Upstate New York Gaming and Economic Development Act. In that article, they referenced a payment to Tompkins County that would be around $1.3 million. Another article came out a couple months later that said it might be $1.7 million. Well, we have just now received the first portion, which comes in at about 1.2. So if there is another portion to come, and that would be for the Tioga Downs casino license fees, which, from what I understand, has not been finalized or approved, nor have they paid for that yet. Once that becomes finalized and paid and distributed, Tompkins County might receive another portion of these fees. I think Joe remarked recently that the governor's budget just added $500,000 or $550,000 to pay for that Tioga Downs license portion. And so, yes, it's less than that we were told originally, but the good news is the first payment will be in the bank tomorrow. The second payment I think we can wait on, especially since none of these monies have been shown in our budget at this point. And I'll take any questions you might have.
Yeah, that's really good news. Thank you. Is that one-time payment?
The license fees are one-time. But that's not to say that later on, once the casinos are up and running, there is a sharing formula that Tompkins County will receive part of the proceeds once they're up and running on an ongoing basis.
Are there any constraints on how we're allowed to spend it?
Not that I know of.
Can we put it on number 17?
might be one Mike constraint Ziegler. There.
My big question is, do we have to take a vote as a legislature? I mean, this legislature has been pretty outspoken about not accepting gambling. I mean, we've taken votes here that we don't approve of that, of what the state's doing, of increasing gambling, especially in our own county. I mean, do we have to take a vote on whether to even accept that money?
No.
Or do we have to take a vote on whether we spend that money in a certain fashion here with the legislature, if we are going to spend it, or are we just going to add it to the general fund? Or are we going to send it back to the taxpayer, since that's really kind of what it's for? So, I mean, there's a lot. I'm almost thinking we should put
Mike,
this in a separate
question.
Well, I'm thinking we should put this in a separate account. We shouldn't just put this in our general fund. Or we should vote whether to accept it at all.
I move we accept it.
I think we should use
the
Red Mill Bridge.
Peter? Is that a serious motion?
I was just being funny.
Okay. By her motion, I got to react. But I think it needs thought. I think back to when we got the tobacco money. And there was a lot of discussion at that time about should that money be used for helping people get off the habit of tobacco addiction, both at the state and at the local level. Frankly, not a lot of that money was used for that at either level. The money we received went to, because it was a lot, we didn't know how long it was going to last, we did pay debt down with it. We had a lot of debate about that at the time. Whether we should have a similar debate to this about this or not, I'm not sure. But I would think that the Budget Committee could take up this question, if you're on the Budget Committee, if you think that's appropriate.
I would like to, if Jim approves. That's fine.
Yeah. Absolutely. In my own small mind, I know a couple places for it immediately as things go on from New York State talking to us. So. And all of you think about it. And you'll know where it may go.
Carol?
Yeah, I was going to go a similar place. I wouldn't, if anybody's planning to bring a motion here on this, I wouldn't start spending it right away until we hear whether the state giveth with one hand and taketh back with the other.
Trust me, you won't see any resolution coming out of the Budget Committee to spend it.
If we're going to spend it, we spend it. We wait until we see what the difference is for the next few years.
All right.
Do I need to repeat myself?
All right. We're not going to decide about this tonight. But, Rick, thank you for sharing that, what I think is good news to us, for us. Anything else in your report, Rick?
No, that's all I have. Thank you.
Maybe you're going to tell us that sales tax is through the roof.
Well, we might have to send some of it back because you have sales tax on. Well, no, never mind.
Thank you. Any resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? Guess not. Let's do the consent agenda. Where is it? Have some appointments from the committees out of Health and Human Services Committee to the Recreation Partnership, Leslie McBean Claiborne and Anna Kellis. To the Greater Ithaca Activities Center, Carol Chalk. To the Human Services Coalition, Martha Robertson. To the Substance Abuse Subcommittee, Susan Robinson. We have resolutions out of Health and Human Services Committee. Resolution A, acceptance of, I think we have a different title for that one, didn't we? Or a revised one?
Acceptance of funds for the Office of
Acceptance of
funds
from the Office of Children and Family Services to address sexually exploited youth Services Department.
There you go.
That's ID something there.
6152.
Okay. Out of Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Resolution B, award of bid, exterior landscaping and snow removal services, Tompkins County Solid Waste Division. That's ID 6196.
I do have some comments about that. So does that
off?
Yeah.
Okay, that's off.
Both the airport and the solid waste.
Okay, you want the next one too? You want Resolution C off?
Correct.
Okay, B and C are off the consent agenda. So the appointments and Resolution A on the consent agenda. Someone want to move that?
Move.
Second.
I don't know who said moved.
I did.
Oh, Leslin. And who seconded it? Dave. All in favor of the consent agenda, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. All right, let's go to the rest of the committees, Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Jim Dennis.
Thank you very much. We have decided April 25th, 5:30 to 7 at TCAT for the, what do we call it?
Budget retreat.
Yeah, the retreat, right. Yeah, budget retreat. And that will be on a Monday evening. We have a regular meeting coming up the 8th, I believe. And I have nothing else. Thank you.
Questions for Jim? Go to Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee. Leslie McBean-Claiborne is the chair.
Mr. Chair, WDIC did not meet since our last legislature meeting. However, I do want to remind you, you should have received a nice-looking flyer like this regarding the Workforce Reading and Discussion Program, which will be beginning soon. It's time to register. Registration is now open, and so we're expecting that some of you or esteemed legislators will register and participate in the reading and discussion group. The theme for this round is respect and civility in the workplace. We also want to take this time to encourage our department heads or supervisors or staff to participate. This is a very good program. Just about every person who's participated in the past, tentative at first, but comes out really being thankful that they've participated and would recommend it. So we do want to encourage you all and others to please do participate. There are four sessions generally. They're on Thursdays, and so we'll be looking for some sign-ups. So please, please, please do sign up and participate. It's really interesting to hear Joe say, the Cup of Joe with Joe, how much the employees get out of meeting and talking with each other and getting to learn more about what each other is doing. This program allows that opportunity for employees from various departments and levels to also get together and talk about issues of diversity and inclusion without it being the taboo, scary subject. And it comes, whether it's magazines or newspaper articles or TED Talks or videos that are used as the stimulus for the discussion. So we do want to encourage people to participate. Thank you.
Questions for Leslie. Martha.
Leslie, I thought you were going to say you're going to encourage the presidential candidates to take this.
Holy crap. We need a whole different kind of reading and discussion program for them.
All right. Thank you, Leslie. Old Library Committee has not met.
I have a question about that.
Sure.
Do we have any idea where this stands in the city's process at this point?
I don't have any detail on that. I know they've been to the city, and I think they've been to the historic
Landmarks
Commission. There you go. And what the result of that, I haven't heard other than what's been in the paper.
Thank you.
Public Safety, Peter Stein, Chair.
Public Safety hasn't met since I last gave a report, and it will meet the day after tomorrow at the usual time.
Questions for Peter. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Dave McKenna's Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll bring forward Resolution B-6196. Award of bid, exterior landscaping, snow removal services, Thomas County Solid Waste Division, and I so move.
There's a second. Seconded by Glenn. All right. Anna, you pulled it?
Yeah.
Yes. I, in a recent discussion, some questions came up about the green scene business that I said I would follow up with them. To find out what their practices were specifically. I spoke to the owner of the company today, and his name is Rick Bio.
They do not, I just want, this is, so this is informational. I am in support of both of these. I am on the F&I committee, obviously, so passed it in the F&I committee. But I wanted to point out that we have been working with Green Scene in solid waste. They have had the contract there for almost 10 years. They do not use any chemicals. They do not use any pesticides. All of the material they use is the compost is organic. They use the highest quality mulch they can find. They are currently starting a project to develop an herb and medicinal herb garden to add to their repertoire of products that they use for their landscaping. So it's pretty much as green a company as I could find. If a client does want to use chemicals, they actually refer them to another company called True Green and do not do the work themselves. So I did want to point out that we are using a company that sounds quite reputable, and they are this president or the director happens to be someone that was referred to me by a sustainability contractor here that has known him for decades and recommended. So on many levels was recommended. But I also forward to all of you a document that was put together by Leo Riley, who is the assistant director at Solid Waste, that outlines the section in the bid specs about what they require, and if a company is going to work for them and use any chemicals, it has to be approved by the legislator or representative of the legislature as it is outlined in the specs. So even if this company were not as green as it is, our bid specs did cover that. So I just wanted to point that out. And that is the company, Green Scene, that came in with the lowest bid by far for both solid waste and the airport. And so I pulled both of those because that was information that was requested, and I wanted to make sure we had that.
Thank you for that information. Are we ready to vote? Oh, Carol?
You know, I just went, you're looking at me because I had asked you the question, so I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. It's really nice to know, and I would assume they are able to do it at a lower bid because they're not purchasing all those expensive and harmful chemicals. So if there's any way that our departments can use this as a way to publicize that you can do your landscaping without them, that'd be great.
Martha?
Yeah, I was just puzzled. I guess I'm sure I've seen this in the past, but why do these two enterprise units not use, county facilities does everybody else's landscaping? Is it that they are separate and would have to pay separately if a RELS department did landscaping for them and so they go out to bid or something?
I think it may be scale as much as anything else. I mean, when you think of facility, they're not equipped to do something as large as the airport. I'm not sure about solid waste, but I think it's a matter of scale, at least at the airport.
Okay, so we've historically just bid those out for...
Okay. Dooley?
Could I ask staff to summarize the information Anna just gave and put that in the minutes? I think that's worth highlighting.
Ready to vote on this resolution B. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. Dave, you want to do C?
Yeah. Okay, now we'll do resolution C, document ID 6192, award of bid exterior landscaping, Thomas County Regional Airport. I so move.
Seconded by Anna. Discussion? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous.
Along with that, we had the previous declaration, or negative declaration, was the other item of discussion, along with a brief discussion of capital plan and related projects and their status. And that's my report.
Questions for Dave? Thank you, David. Transportation Committee did meet. We had a nice report from Fernando de Aragon and also from Ed Marks regarding the process that we're going through to try to get ready eventually for more electric cars in Tompkins County. And basically, there is a study that's going to go forward through the MPO to look at what would be potential sites, what would be potential use, how they would be set out there for people who to encourage them to buy electric cars. All the questions that you could probably think of, the consultants are going to be looking at, with the possibility of then trying to get some grant funding to put in some of these charging stations. We have a few in Tompkins County, but if we want to become a county where there is less carbon footprint from automobile gasoline engines, then we need a reasonable alternative to that. Along with mass transit that we work at all the time, we need to have automobiles that function well in our area, in our climate, and also have the way to get recharged where they need to. So that was one of the things we did. We'd hope to have some representatives from TCAT to start talking about the need for buses and things, which we all know about. But we weren't able to get that for this meeting, but we're hoping to do that for our next meeting. We're also hoping to invite representatives from the New York State DOT in Syracuse to one of our meetings. Any questions I can answer? Thank you. Government Operations Committee, Dan Klein is the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At our next meeting, we are going to probably be finally voting on the Biggs property about whether to authorize the sale or not. The committee has been looking at this for a really long time, and I think we're probably ready to take action at this point. The meeting is going to be this Friday, March 18th at 3 o'clock, right in this room. So I just want to make sure everyone realizes that's a different date and time than normal.
Questions for Dan? Thanks, Dan. Charter Review, Julie Kiefer is the chair.
Charter Review meets in exactly 1 week at 3 p.m. here.
That's questions? Thank you, Dooley. Planning, Development, Environmental Quality Committee. Martha Robertson is the chair.
Thank you, Mike. We met on Friday, March 11th, when we heard from Omai Elfick on for
He's
gravity
renewal.
I know. So we had a great conversation with him and spent even more time than we did tonight. But that was a special meeting. Our regular meeting is tomorrow at 3 o'clock. And probably the single biggest item on the agenda is accepting the Tompkins County Energy Roadmap, evaluating our energy resources. So staff has boiled it down to 10 pages. It looks like this. So if you haven't gotten one in your... If you don't get the PDEC package, I'm sure you can. I don't know whether this is online yet, but in any case, you can. I'm sure it'll be coming to the full legislature for a full discussion and report. We're also going to be talking about joining the Ithaca 2030 district, which has to do with building planning for sustainability in the downtown area. And some transportation issues, so that's tomorrow. Oh, and also we'll be hearing from folks from the REV, the business, the Ithaca startup, especially the passenger to pilot, Representative Ariana Blossom. So that's tomorrow at 3 o'clock.
Carol, question.
I just wanted to fill in that the entire energy roadmap draft is online, of which I think this is the first 9 or 10 pages, with the introduction and the executive summary and a bunch of other summaries and charts. It's much more easily readable. But if any committee members or others want to see the whole ball of wax technical information that the committee looked at, that is there as well. And if you go to the planning department website, there's links and follow them and you'll get to it.
Well,
Martha, what is the passenger to pilot?
Passenger to pilot refers to, it's a subgroup of the REV that is about for women entrepreneurs. So the idea of being, they often start out as passengers in business development, and then this is supporting women taking on the role of starting their own businesses or, you know, taking over business.
Thank you.
Okay. Can we take the minutes of the previous meeting, March 1st? Someone want to move those? Dave, seconded by Anna. Discussion? All those in favor of the minutes, please raise your hand. Those opposed? We have one opposed. Any unfinished business? One thing that's not finished with the old Civil War Commission is our efforts to have the Civil War Nurses Monument constructed at TC3. And I want you to know that after fundraising was successfully done, they are moving ahead with that. The monument is being actually built. One of our nurses has made it. One of our four nurses, Susan Hall, has made a list. Senator O'Mara has told us. Help me, Marcia. What the list at the state level of some of the most influential historic women, and she is one of them. She is from Ulysses area. So she'll be in our monument as well. And,
that was beautiful.
And by the way, she thought you'd like to know about that.
Thank you.
Anything else? We need to go into executive session to discuss litigation. We expect to come out of executive session and not take any action when we're done. May I have a motion to move into it? Anna, seconded by Peter. All in favor of executive session, please raise your hand. Those opposed? All right. We'll shut down long enough to excuse our visitors and media and shut the cameras down.